Okay, we're good to go. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the October 20th, 2021st meeting of the Transit Commission. We will not have a consent agenda today because we're going to hold all items. I've received no regrets today, so I'm assuming we're all here. Could the Commission Coordinator please proceed with the roll call?
Commissioner Brockington.
Here.
Commissioner Caricato.
Here.
Commissioner Gower.
Here.
Commissioner Kavanaugh.
Here.
Commissioner McKenney. Commissioner Olson.
Present.
Commissioner Tierney. Commissioner Williams.
Here.
Commissioner Wright Gilbert.
Good morning, here.
Vice Chair Klutzi.
Is that?
Chair Hubley.
Here.
You have quorum, Chair.
Thank you, Eric. Okay, are there any declarations of interest for this meeting? Okay, seeing none, are the minutes of the Transit Commission meeting of Monday, September 20th confirmed? They should have all been circulated to all of you.
Carried.
Thank you. Now we'll go into the first item of the agenda relating to the collective bargaining mandate will be considered in camera pursuant to the procedure bylaw because it relates to labor relations, employee negotiations, and receiving advice that is subject to the solicitor-client privilege. If you could please ask the vice chair, if I could please ask the vice chair to move and resolve in camera.
Thank you, Chair. Be it resolved that in accordance with procedure by law, City Council resolve in camera pursuant to subsection 13.1D, labor relations or employee negotiations, and 13.1F, receiving of advice that is subject to solicitor-client privilege, including communications necessary for that purpose, receive and consider an update on collective bargaining's mandate for negotiations, Amalgamated Transit Union Local 279, Paratranspo, and QP 5500, not to be reported at.
Thank you. Is that motion carried?
Carried.
Thank you. I would ask that members and invited staff join the confidential Teams meeting now. The information was emailed to everyone that's required to attend. If you don't have it, please notify the clerk. And for the benefit of the public, we anticipate that the in-camera session will be relatively brief. If the clerk's office could please move all the members and staff in Zoom over to the attendees section now, please. There we go. Get myself off mute. Okay, I think we're ready to go back. Please let the record show that the Transit Commission went in camera to receive a presentation from the city solicitor regarding collective bargaining and the mandate for negotiations. These matters will not be reported out as they relate to labor relations or employee negotiations and advice that is subject to solicitor-client privilege. Moving on to the agenda. The next item is the Confederation Line and Bus Service update. And before proceeding with the presentation from staff, I understand the city manager, Mr. Steve Kanalakis, would like to provide some introductory remarks. Go ahead when ready, Steve.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Transit Commissioners and other members of council who have joined the meeting today. I wanted to say a few words this morning on Line 1 and the ongoing situation before passing the floor over to Troy Charter and Pat Scrimger, who are going to walk you through a detailed presentation on our update for OC Transpo, return to service, and other topics that are first and foremost the front of your minds. I also want to welcome our new general manager, Rene Amilcar, who's taken over transit services on Monday. This is her first Transit Commission meeting, And Rennie joined the City of Ottawa Monday and has hit the ground running meeting key people and her team over at OC Transpo. And she's in the meeting today, but won't be an active participant. She's, as you can appreciate, has a lot of files to get briefed up on and get caught up on. But I was fortunate to spend time with Rennie early this week discussing this file and many others. And I know she's going to be a strong leader and will carry the transit service torch well, given her extensive knowledge and expertise in the field. But it's, you know, not an easy time to be joining us. It's an extremely challenging time for Ottawa residents and transit customers. And as yesterday, our light rail transit system has been out of service for a full month. And she understands the severity of the situation that we're in. We can't stress enough that this is not the level of transit service our residents expect and deserve. We need a safe and reliable LRT system for our community, and we're working all out to do that. Rennie arrived to see that OC Transpo staff are working around the clock to continue to push Rideau Transit Group to get this system back up and running. And I have full confidence in her and the extraordinary staff at OC Transpo who are dedicated to the safe resumption of LRT service and are working for the Transit Commission for Council to make that happen. We all want LRT line up and running, but we can't compromise when it comes to safety. I've been clear about that from the beginning. We will not accept the return to service of the old train Confederation Line 1 until we're satisfied that it's safe and reliable. That will not be compromised under any circumstances. As you've been told, the independent rail safety experts, TRA, are actively working here in Ottawa. They're reviewing RTG's return to service plan, and I'm pleased to have them here today so that transit commissioners can hear firsthand from their experience and what they have learned today, and to ask any questions they wish for as long as it takes for them to satisfy transit commissioners and councillors of what they're seeing and what their expectations are for return to service. As I communicated to you on Monday, Rideau Transit Group has proposed a tentative return to service date of November 1st. And people have been saying, oh, is that realistic? It may be achieved. We're not sure at this point. A lot of things have to go right for service or some sort of service to come back by November 1st. But at this time, we think a more likely scenario is that it'll be sometime in the first 2 weeks of November, where we can have 7 trains in the spare operating. And as you'll learn today, there are a number of checks and balances that need to occur before the city can confirm a reliable date for a safe return to service. Today, OC Transpo staff will walk you through in detail the steps required to safely return LRT to service. And this includes an update on the root cause analysis, investigations, actions taken to date, and future work required. They'll talk to you about TRA's role on this on behalf of the city and our riders. And they'll also provide you the details on the efforts being made to improve R1 service during this very challenging time. We've made progress since we were together last month, but as you learn, there's still lots of work to be done with this system. We need our partner, Rideau Transit Group, to provide us with the highest standard of service to our residents that we Ottawans expect and that we contracted for, and will continue to hold their feet to the fire. And we have engaged top rail safety experts in North America to provide us with their guidance. So we have what I believe are an excellent team on the ground, ensuring that this gets back up and running safely. Today is Rennie's third day with us. I'm looking forward to her observations too, and I'll continue to be actively involved in this work personally, and will continue to keep members of council and the Transit Commission informed of any developments. I thank you for your patience and support during this challenging time. I thank the residents of Ottawa for their patience during this challenging time. I know they're frustrated, and I thank the Transit Commission for their leadership also. As I promised to the September Transit Commission meeting, a technical briefing will be held prior to the launch of the service, so you'll have an opportunity to understand the safe restart plan and ask questions of city staff and TRA. I repeat, we will not be launching this system until we've done a technical briefing with council, ensuring that you have every opportunity to ask questions and understand what's been done before this system is launched back in service. I'll now pass the floor on to Troy Charter, Mr. Chair, who will begin the update presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kanellakis.
Thank you, Mr. Kanellakis. If Eric, if you could pull up the presentation, that'd be appreciated. All right, perfect. And if you can go to the next slide, please. Start off just a quick overview of the agenda for today. we'll provide just an overview, a bit of some context as to where we currently are. We'll then move into an update on the safe return to RTG safe to return to service plan and the next steps. Provide some information with regards to some of the ongoing reliability monitoring, and then we'll get into the details with regards to the recent safety incidents. More specifically, with regards to September 19th, I'll provide more of a detailed update similar to what we did for the August 8th derailment. And then at that point, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Pat Scrimger, who will provide an update on the R1 replacement bus service. Next slide, please. So as we know, Line 1 has experienced two derailments, both one on August 8th and one on September 19th. Both resulted in the suspension of service. August 8th, it was approximately a five-day suspension of service. And then today, obviously, we're over a month of running our one bus service without the trains. In both events, all our emergency response protocols were followed as outlined in our safety management system. And that includes notification to all the appropriate bodies, including the Transport Canada, the Transportation Safety Board, the Regulatory Monitoring Compliance Officer, Mr. Sam Barada, as well as the City Manager and Council. Our one bus replacement service was implemented immediately, and obviously that's where we currently stand. You'll hear throughout this presentation, the safety of our customers and our staff remains our number one priority. And that's why we'll be very, very adamant. And as I said, you'll hear it a few times. Line 1 service will only resume following confirmation that RTG's Rideau Transit Group's return to service plan adequately addresses all the safety and service requirements. Next slide, please. So with regards to the safe return to service plan, as was communicated on October 15th, RTG did provide the city with its return to service plan. That plan is currently under review with Transportation Research Associates, or TRA, and they're doing so in consultation with the Regulatory Monitor and Compliance Officer, Mr. Sam Barada. To meet our expectations, the plan must include both immediate actions for service to resume safely, as well as longer-term actions that are going to sustain a safe and reliable operation. You just heard from Mr. Kanellakis that subject to the TRA review and validation process, RTG is targeting a partial return to service on November 1st. But based on our information, based on all the steps that are required to verify the safety of the LRT system, we anticipate that partial service would resume sometime within the first 2 weeks of November. It is important to note that all these dates are considered tentative because they are subject to an intensive inspection program on the entire fleet, as well as TRA's concurrence that the plan is robust, is supported by safety and quality reports, and will sustain a safe and reliable return to service. Four elements of the safe return to service plan have been formed by the root cause analyses, and the core plan includes complete root cause analysis, and they need that to assess both the appropriate short-term and long-term mitigations.
I will after you.
We're expecting to see confirmation that the repairs to the track, the signals, and systems are complete. They've been validated and tested. They will also undertake an intensive fleet inspection program of all the critical safety components and hardware on every single car and every single train. And additionally, implementation of a quality assurance, quality governance process specific to the overall return to service plan. Critically, what the city is looking for is, we're looking to see an introduction of additional quality control checks, increased oversight, and increased vehicle inspections. Expecting to see as well confirmation that staff are properly trained to perform these additional tasks, are adequately resourced, and the necessary process improvements, including the quality checks and sign-offs, are in place. Confirmation that all the elements of the plan are supported by the appropriate documentation, safety and quality reports, checklists, and approvals of all the work performed, and most importantly, confirmation that the trains, track and rail systems, including the computer-based train control system, have been tested and following a period of trial operations deemed safe to return to service. Additionally, go to the next slide, please. Additionally, and separate to the return to service plan, RTG's subcontractor, Alstom, they've committed to also a four-tiered approach to correcting issues and sustaining a safe and reliable system. This additional focus is some things like leadership competency and how the work is structured, but essentially they'll be focusing efforts on uplifting the competencies of the leadership and supervisor teams here on site in Ottawa. separating maintenance and vehicle modification activities, improving the process and tools for the maintenance of vehicles infrastructure, and then overall to strive to regain a professional, productive work environment by injecting fresh and qualified resources in addition to the team that's presently here. Next slide, please. And you know, you've heard from the city manager that you know, the city has hired Transportation Research Associates to undertake an independent third-party safety review. TRA will review RTG's relaunch plan and will make recommendations to the city on the proposed LRT relaunch service plan. Ultimately, RTG is responsible for implementing the return to service plan. And, you know, as an additional check and balance, TRA will be monitoring the effective execution of that plan. Slide, please. The safe to return service requirements, you've heard already, but the final return to service date will only be determined once all the due diligence has been taken and that we are satisfied it is safe. You know, I know everyone wants to see the train back in service as quickly as possible, but we all share the same view. It's got to be safe. It's got to be reliable. Mr. Sam Barada of the RMCO, he remains engaged and is reviewing the safety of the system, as well as the overall soundness of the city's approach. The Transportation Safety Board continued to be actively engaged since the derailment, and their investigation is ongoing and independent of the city's review. Once the TRA recommends to the city that RTG is ready to resume service, the city will verify RTG's ability to safely and reliably relaunch the system, and this will include a few days of testing of the service. It's at that time where residents may see trains up running on the line, and that's part of our testing and verification process. The final date for return to service will determine once the city is satisfied. You know, and as once again, as you heard from the city manager, a technical briefing by the TRA team will be provided in advance of Line 1's return to service. Next slide, please. I'll now talk a little bit about the ongoing reliability monitoring, and then I'll get into some details on the recent safety incidents. Next slide, please. Since the rail line opened, there have been a number of technical issues affecting the reliability of the service and ultimately our customers. This is well known. We've talked about it, at previous Transit Commission meetings. RTG's previous rectification work to address those reliability and technical issues did result in approximately 11 months of service reliability of 97 to 99% range of planned service delivered. We did see improvements. Strong winter performance followed the installation of the gas-powered switch heaters in the East End, and that improved remote monitoring capability. I believe last winter we had approximately 15 weather events where it was 3 to 4 centimeters or more, and those switch heaters performed well, and we didn't have, I think we only had one minor issue in which there was a warranty a piece of equipment on the switch heaters needed to be replaced, and it was under warranty. Due to the braking systems adjustments, the wheel flats and the associated negative impacts on the fleet, that hasn't recurred. Modifications to the line inductors and the line contactors have resolved the arcing issues that impacted service in the winter of 2019 and 2020. I think we can all remember New Year's Eve. That was a very challenging night, but we haven't seen a return of those issues. The SIL2 certified door software that was implemented resolved the door sensitivity challenges and associated service impact. Service impacts due to the train control and management system, TCMS, and as well as the VOBC, or the vehicle onboard controller, those train communication issues as a result of the software modifications and updates have been addressed and are no longer a significant contributing cause of in-service failures. Additionally, the HVAC systems continue to be monitored in extreme weather events and have performed to expectations over the past summer and winter months. And lastly, as a result of the repairs and the maintenance changes to the overhead catenary system, or we also refer to as OCS, those service disruptions have not recurred as well due to any sort of OCS breakage. But as we communicated before, all the modifications and the rectification work are subject to the ongoing third-party validation to ensure that the solutions to resolve those issues actually do resolve them and that they can be sustained for the long term. Next slide, please. Not all the work is complete, however. The city continues to track the reliability and technical items. A few of the key ones, your track work performance, As you will recall, significant grinding of the rails and ballast work was undertaken this past summer. However, you know, a detailed wheel rail interface study is required to assess the vehicle noise and vibration through curves. And we've heard from our customers, we've heard from the counselors that they are still experiencing some noise and vibration, especially on the curves. So that is some additional work that we're doing. Additional items such as slow track orders and just overall track performance continue to be monitored and assessed. The vehicle auxiliary power equipment, or CVS units, this item is still outstanding from the original rectification plan, and Alstom is changing equipment suppliers in order to help address this issue. With that said, with some of the adjustments that have been made in the software, it's not a contributing factor to in-service failures, but we can't consider it resolved at this time. And then with regards to the cracked wheels, the process to replace the cracked wheels continues. I know it says on the slide there are 7 vehicles remaining. It's actually now 6 vehicles remaining. And some additional information can be found on the TSB report that's referenced on this slide. Next slide, please. So I'll talk about the August 8th derailment, and then I'll get into more detail on the September 19th one. So as we're aware, following the August 8th derailment near Tunney's Pasture Station, the Alstom fleet was grounded to enable an entire fleet-wide inspection. The TSB report is noted as complete on their website, and the TSB did issue a rail safety advisory letter, which I'll talk about shortly. The root cause investigation in this matter is continuing and involves, it's a fairly detailed process. There's grease lab and metallic part analysis. They're going through some finite element modeling and design analysis, track load surveys to look at how the train and the wheels interact with the track, as well as continuing to look at the vendor and potential root causes with some of the parts that are provided by vendors to Alstom and to RTG. RTG expects to provide updates on the root cause investigation sometime in December of this year. I believe, as previously communicated, in order to mitigate the failures, Alstom has implemented an increased inspection frequency, it's every 7,500 kilometers or less, to detect potential axle failures, and a specific test called axle play verification as indicative axle failure mode. This increased inspection regime will continue. It will continue until such time as the root cause is fully known, as well as the final solution is implemented on the entire fleet. Next slide, please. The Transportation Safety Board, in their feedback to the city, noted that the use of onboard thermal monitoring technology for detection of axle failures should be reviewed. While this is not common for light rail systems, it is something that is being looked at and will be considered as part of the steps moving forward. But it is important to note that as part of the original design and construction, RTG was required to provide safety certification for the complete system, trains, track, computer-based train control, the entire system. And that certification includes the identification of all the hazards, as well as the identification of all the mitigations for those hazards. The list of mitigations did not include onboard thermal monitoring. So in other words, this wasn't like a selection process where staff chose which mitigations to put in place. This was part of an all-encompassing package from RTG, and it was part of that safety certification process. However, as I mentioned, given the incident in August and the supplemental inspections that are now required, additional condition monitoring tools and long-term solutions are being assessed. Specifically, onboard changes that enable thermal detection and or slip slide reporting to the operator, as well as automated tools on the wayside on the track, thermal detection or other target solutions are all currently being assessed and being evaluated for their effectiveness and how they can fit onto our system. Concurrently, the city is also looking more holistically across the entire system to assess opportunities for increased condition monitoring, and this would include catenary vehicles, track, and systems. Now moving on to the September 19th derailment, which occurred between Tremblay and Herdman stations, and we know that there was significant infrastructure damage to the track, as well as some significant damage to the train. Service on O-Train Line 1 was suspended in order to take a thorough review of the event, as well as to assess the requirements for a safe return to service. The city's, you know, as I mentioned, the city's RMCO is engaged in the review of the investigation, and the city manager has, you know, as previously indicated, has engaged TRA to review RTG's return to service plan. TSB has, you know, their preliminary investigation provides some additional photographs and information on this incident, and we do have some photographs coming later in the presentation here. So the next few slides, I'll provide an overview of the event. So at approximately 12:15 on Sunday, a westbound train came to a stop due to a derailed bogie. Each bogie has two axles and four wheels, and this occurred between Tremblay and Herdman stations. You know, the picture on the side shows the approximate location. The train was traveling in the, as I said, in the westbound direction. So you can see in blue, that's the location where the train came to a stop. So at the top of the screen would be, just out of the picture, would be Tremblay Station. And at the bottom right hand of the screen, you can see where the those Herdman curves start, and Herdman would be just a you know, two curves ahead where that location was. All stakeholders were immediately engaged: Metro Transit Maintenance, Chief Safety Officer, RMCO, TSB, and Transport Canada. At approximately 12:45 p.m., Line 1 service was suspended, and all trains were stopped at the nearest station. At approximately 1 o'clock, customers on board the derailed train, as there were customers on board, were provided assistance to exit the vehicle, and full R1 bus replacement service was implemented end-to-end from the time of the incident to where we stand today. Next slide, please. Continuing with a bit of a chronology, at approximately 12:50, customers were notified of a stopped train and R1 bus service from Rideau to Blair. At approximately 1:25, customers were then notified that train service was unavailable and a full R1 bus service was operating from Honey's Pasture to Blair stations. OC Transpo, OPS, and OFS responded to assist customers on the train, so we had great response from our emergency response providers. And it was great, you know, there's no injuries were reported either with customers or the operator, but we had a great response from emergency response providers, so I'd like to thank them for attending. OC Transpo staff, RTM, and TSB officials immediately began the investigation of the cause of the derailment, and later on that day, a media availability was held at 5:30. You know, as I mentioned, there were trains that were out, obviously trains that were out at line that were stopped at the nearest stations. So each non-impacted train was inspected by a technician prior to being returned to the maintenance and storage facility. The vehicles were driven back at a reduced speed with technicians on board. As part of TSB's review of the incident, the city was informed that the affected area and any related materials on the guideway on the rail line were to stay in position until further notice. They wanted to make sure they collected all their necessary information for their investigation, and we were put temporarily on hold, you know, as they gathered all that fact and that detail. On September 21st, TSB had cleared the site, and as a result, you know, the train could start to be re-railed and move back to maintenance storage facility in Belfast Yard, and then at that point, the infrastructure repair work could start. On the following day, next slide, please, on September 22nd, the vehicle was re-railed, and it was returned back to Belfast Yard. The train was re-railed by the Alstom technicians, and similar to the previous event, it was moved back at a slow speed with people walking beside it, following all safety procedures and best practices. It was moved back to Belfast Yard that same day. And as I said, staff walked alongside it, and you know, primarily it's to make sure that there's no further damage to the train or other rail infrastructure, and make sure that it gets back safely without incident. In terms of our customer service response, there were updates, tweets, and SMS messages. Go next slide, please, Eric. That's great. There were website updates, tweets, and SMS text messages were issued to our customers. On-site staff supported customers in person across the system at all times. We were able to redeploy our rail operators, and they continue to be out there to provide assistance to customers. Over the few hours following the derailment, signs were placed outside the stations pointing customers to R1 bus stops. And then, you know, we had that, as I mentioned, the media availability later in the day, and continue to provide updates to council as well as the media over the next few days. With respect to the preliminary findings, the investigation, the root cause and damage as a result of the derailment indicates that prior to the train arriving at Tremblay Station, a gearbox, which is located on the outside of the body of the train, started to drop in. And I'll show you some pictures of, and I'll talk a little bit about the gearbox and to give you better context. But as this gearbox began to drop, it started to make intermittent contact with the railroad ties, leaving marks in advance of Tremblay Station. The wheels, and we also know that the wheels on one of the motor bogies was in a derailed state when the train left Tremblay Station. Next slide, please. There were no abnormalities that were noted and reported by the operator when the train departed the station. And the train traveled, as I mentioned, from Tremblay Station to just west of Riverside Drive, when the gearbox that, you know, had, you know, as I said, had been dropping, you know, came detached as it made contact with the signal mast and switch heater, and you've seen the damage, and I think I have a picture of that coming up. The computer-based train control system brought the train to a stop. As a result, there was significant damage to the train as well as the rail infrastructure, and some of the damage to the train includes the light rail passenger door that is located right above that affected bogey, the one that was derailed, was damaged as well. The picture you see here is the track at Tremblay Station, and it's where we believe that the gearbox dug into the rock and the ballast. And if you look closely, you can see there's damage to those railroad ties. And you can see actually in the middle, top middle of the picture, you can see a gap between the rock and the tie. And what you want to see there is, you know, you shouldn't see that gap. So there, you know, that gearbox, which is a very, very heavy component, was digging into the ballast and the ties, which contributed to the damage, and ultimately, as I said, resulted in the derailment. A damage assessment was conducted on the vehicle, as well as a complete walkthrough of the rail line. With respect to the track and infrastructure, the switch machine and the switch heater were damaged. Signal posts and concrete pad was damaged. As well, there was many broken and chipped concrete ties. There was rail clips and clamps that hold the rail tightly in place were damaged or were knocked off. Track bolts and balance were damaged and all required replacement. On the specific to the vehicle, the gearbox and some related components, the traction motor and related components, you know, some of the wheels, the train door, and then side of body and glass panels were all damaged. And the maintenance and the correct repairs to that vehicle, as well as the entire fleet check, continue on all the vehicles at this time. Next slide, please. I can report at this time that all the track and infrastructure repairs were effectively completed by October 18th. You can see in the picture here, this is the signal mast and the fixed switch machine in place, as well as you can see that the ballast to the rock that holds those ties in place has been rebuilt up. All those systems, though, although the repairs are complete, all the systems will require verification testing, confirming that they're prepared to be released back into service. We will at some point need to launch some test trains to conduct the additional measurements and validate that infrastructure. But that will come following, you know, confirmation that it would be safe to launch some test trains at that time. And as I previously mentioned, an intensive fleet-wide inspection is required to assess and validate the integrity of all the trains. And that will be done on the entire fleet. Some information on the root cause investigation. It does continue. The root cause investigation doesn't continue. But we do know that the derailed vehicle had recently undergone axle repairs to replace the axle bearing assembly from the August 8th derailment. This isn't the same vehicle that derailed in August 8th, but if you recall, following the inspections that occurred after the August 8th, there were 10 vehicles that were identified as needing axle repairs. This is one of those vehicles that had those repairs. And this axle specifically had recently undergone a replacement of the axle bearing assembly. Although it was initially believed to be an issue with the sanding bracket that caused the derailment, and there was a broken sanding bracket there at the location, but that was later determined through the ongoing investigation that broke as a result of the gearbox and the derailment. But, you know, RTG and Alstom have been able to confirm that the primary cause of the derailment has to do with improperly torqued bolts on the gearbox. And as I mentioned, the gearbox appeared to have dropped down and impacted the rail infrastructure. So the top picture there, you see this is the damaged bogey. And if you look at the wheel there, there's there's a blue mark around it, and there's a missing component that you'll see in a moment, and that's where it that gearbox broke off. And in the bottom picture there, that is the gearbox. I don't think the picture gives it credit to the sheer weight and size of it. You know, it's not something that several people could lift. It's a very heavy piece of equipment that actually requires some machinery to lift it up and to be able to move it. If we can move to the next slide, I'll talk a little bit about bogies, and I'll give a little bit more context at that point. So each light rail car has five bogies, essentially, three motor bogies and two trailer bogies. The motor bogies are comprised of many components, including axles, wheels, bearings, frames, brakes, motors, and obviously gearboxes. The gearbox is the mechanism that couples the motor to the axles, and as well, the gearbox facilitates the energy transfer from the motor to the wheels, which is required to propel them forward. So the slide here shows, the next slide, please, Eric. This is a picture of a motor bogey that's on a train in the MSF. We've got the side panels lifted up so you can see. So on the right-hand side of the bogey, that's the gearbox that you can see that's attached to that wheel. The middle is the traction motor, and then on the left is the braking mechanism for that bogey. The next slide shows a picture of a bogey that has been removed from a train. This is a non-damaged a bogey, and once again, you can see if you look at the bottom right-hand wheel, that large piece of equipment, that's the gearbox that is fixed to that wheel, and then you have the traction motor beside it, and then once again, the brakes on the left-hand side. And then the next picture shows a picture of a bogey. Once again, it's an undamaged bogey, but it's had the gearbox removed. So the gearbox gets affixed to that what we call stub shaft that's protruding out from the wheel. And you look, there's a series of there's three rows of bolts. It's that innermost series of bolts that were improperly torqued that resulted in that gearbox eventually coming loose, dropping down, and then eventually making contact with the rail infrastructure, and then breaking off from the train at that point. Go to the next slide, please. So the overall safe return to service, as I mentioned, the final timing of the service resumption will be confirmed following, firstly, TRA's acceptance of RTG's safety plan. Secondly, TRA's acceptance of RTG's evidence detailing the execution of the plan and confirmation by the city that the stations, infrastructure, and the systems are ready. As I said, RTG is responsible for implementing the return to service plan. And that date, when we have that date, and we'll share that as more information becomes available, will be determined only once all the due diligence has been taken. There will be no shortcuts taken. We do plan to do 1 to 2 days of testing to validate and verify that the service can resume. And I can't stress it enough. The final return to service date will be determined once we're satisfied that all the right checks and balances in place and all the necessary actions have been taken. And as you heard from the city manager, a technical briefing by the TRA team will be provided in advance of Line 1's return to service. So it's at this time, I'll turn things over to my colleague, Pat Skinder, who will provide an update on the R1 replacement bus service. Thank you.
Thank you, Troy. Eric, next slide, please. So just a few words on the replacement bus service that we're running, the R1 service. Obviously, while the train service is not operating, replacement bus service is operating between all stations. R1 bus is operated every few minutes, different frequencies at different times of the day as required by customer volumes, over the same span of hours over the day and over each day of the week as O-Train service. The replacement buses operate in mixed traffic on streets and highways, but use bus lanes when they're available. But the replacement bus service can never be as fast, as reliable, or have as much capacity as regular train service when it operates. Next slide, please. In order to provide more capacity and reduce crowding on the buses, we moved high capacity buses from other routes to the R1 service starting on September 21st. Other improvements that we've made include adding express trips from Blair to downtown in the morning rush hour operating on the highway and bypassing all of the intermediate stations to make trips faster to downtown, and that started on September 21st. We added similar trips in the afternoon from downtown, bypassing all the intermediate stops to Blair, starting on September 24th. Starting on September 27th, we had all trips all day long on all 7 days of the week, bypassing Sevierville Station to make the trips faster for everyone traveling to and from the east. And we added a special shuttle service that carries people from Saint Laurent to Sevierville. Next slide, please. Following that, we added additional trips between Tunney's Pasture and downtown in the morning and from downtown to Tunney's Pasture in the afternoon to increase capacity and reduce crowding. And that started on September 29th. And also, we had on September 21st loaded the R1 bus service schedules into our online customer information system so people could could get information on the scheduled service and could also use the online travel planner to see what is the best way to make their trips with the R1 buses in place. Next slide, please. Now, of course, we're constrained by resource availability because we have bus operators, maintenance staff, supervisors, and others who are working to sustain service across the entire OC Transpo network, including the R1 service. And they're working as much overtime as possible, and everyone who can be shifted to sustain the service from any other task is doing so. For instance, staff who would normally be standing by to back up regular service, working on the R1 service, and still working on the additional school trips that we've been running since the beginning of September to backfill for the workforce shortages at the school bus companies. Some operators were made available by delaying their training for their future transfer to rail operations for the forthcoming Line 2 reopening. And then we had to go further, and in order to get enough capacity on our R1 to carry all the customers, we made some reductions by canceling specific and individual trips across the network on many other routes to provide extra buses to go onto the R1 service. And in addition, as Troy mentioned earlier, the rail operators who would normally be driving those trains are at the stations along the line, assisting customers to know where to catch the R1 or with any other questions customers might have. Next slide, please. So one of the things that came up at council last week is we were asked to provide a weekly summary of the trips that are canceled on other routes. This on this page, these are the trips that have been canceled since September 24th. On the routes that are listed there, some of these routes are in each direction. The full details were in a memo that we sent on September 23rd. These trips have been canceled every day since September 24th. What we'll be doing now is we're also going to, follow the direction of council, we'll be putting out a weekly summary of additional trips that were canceled on other routes. And you'll see the first of those reporting on last week coming up in the next few days. And then we'll do that weekly until the service suspension on the train is over. The next slide, please. Obviously, as I said earlier, the replacement bus service is never as good and can never be as good as the train service when the train service is running regularly. In addition, running this R1 replacement bus service causes effects to other customers across the rest of the network. Removing buses from the other routes by canceling trips has caused inconvenience to customers in other parts of the system. In all cases, it's a longer waiting time. In some cases, it reduces their opportunity to travel and reduces and makes more difficult some of the connections they're making. Similarly, removing high capacity buses from other routes to put them on the R1 service has made buses on those other routes more crowded. But our staff have worked very, very carefully to minimize the negative effect. It's still a negative effect, but to minimize it by avoiding first trips in the morning, last trips in the afternoon or evening, avoiding school trips, which are or any other specific trips, and avoiding two trips in a row, consecutive trips on a schedule. But as I said earlier, the result is that customers in many parts of the system have longer waits and less reliable service than they would normally expect. We also reduced the number of bus trips that were operating to Red Blacks and Senators games, matching their current attendance levels and lower ridership than we've had in past years pre-pandemic. Next slide, please. So we're managing the service. All of our teams are all of our bus related teams, those aren't working on the safe restart of the train service, are working on maintaining and sustaining the best R1 bus service that is possible under the circumstances. Sustaining, as I said, the rest of the system remains very important, especially after those trip cancellations have increased waiting times on other routes across the system. Sustaining the school services that were added this fall because of the workforce shortages at school bus companies also remains very important. Our Transit Operations Control Center is working at an enhanced level and has its command center activated. And that service command center has a special R1 task force with staff coming together from all parts of OC Transpo plus traffic services, looking every day at how the previous day ran, what are the current issues, are there any problems to solve, are there any problems that we can solve, and are there any enhancements we can make? And we've also got on-street supervisors and customer support staff out on the street and at the stations supporting the service and assisting customers. Next slide, please. So as we look forward to the forthcoming resumption of train service, the train will return to its place as the core of the OC Transpo system, and R1 can back away a little bit and become more of a support in those early days. The trains will provide better service for customers when they're running again. They'll provide faster service between stations, faster service across the length of the line. Those trains, of course, will not be affected by on-street traffic conditions. The trains are bigger and have more capacity. All of these things will allow the replacement bus service to be gradually reduced. We may need to continue to provide some supplementary service with buses until full train service has resumed, and we'll be working on that as the pace of the return of each of the trains becomes clear. As the replacement and the supplementary bus service is reduced, as the need for that is reduced over time, we will be able to restore more and more of the canceled trips across the system. And we'll be looking forward to doing that and getting everyone's service back to usual levels as soon as we can, but taking everyone's needs into account. But the next slide, please, and I'll turn it back to Troy to outline the next steps.
Just one final recap before I turn things over to Mr. Dan Hauber of the Transportation Research Associates, who will provide a presentation as well. These are all the important points here is that, TRA is undertaking the independent review of RTG's return to service plan. The city, in working with the TRA and the RMCL, will verify RTG's ability to safely and reliably relaunch the O-Train Line 1. Once testing is complete and satisfactory, a final return to service date will be announced. As you mentioned a few times, a technical briefing with TRA officials prior to the launch of service will occur. Staff will continue to support the ongoing and independent TSB investigation and will continue to provide regular updates as they become available. So that concludes our portion of the presentation. I'll now turn things over to Mr. Dan Hauber.
Thank you, Troy. Good morning. Good morning, commissioners, councillors, members, and thank you for the opportunity to go through this presentation with you here today. I know we're a little bit limited for time, so I'll try to stay on point here and perhaps truncate some of the points that Troy has covered. Well, go ahead to the next slide, please. So just a brief history of TRA and who we are. TRA has been in business for over 30 years now. We're focused specifically on transit, on public transit, and especially on rail transit and on rail transit safety. We have a strong history of independent safety investigations, safety assessments, incident investigations, hazard and safety risk analyses. Currently, we have 16 projects that we're involved in that involve direct rail safety oversight of transit agencies, several of which, roughly half of which involve light rail lines as well. We're in the business of assessing organizational issues after safety incidents and the impact of safety organization, operations and maintenance organization, and the impact that those things have on safety incidents and accidents. Our team for this work in particular includes six key personnel with over 170 years of experience. They're also supported by the rest of the TRA organization, which includes approximately another 24 transit professionals that we can call on as needed. The next slide, please. So I'd like to talk a little bit about our scope of work and some of the areas that that we anticipate concentrating on through our work and some of the things that we've already started on. As I mentioned earlier, Troy has covered a little bit of this, so I'll try to be selective here about the areas that we talk through. Our work is focused on assessing the safety plans, corrective action plans, and remediation after the two derailments that Troy mentioned earlier. Our work is also focused on overseeing and reporting on the readiness of the entire Confederation line to re-enter service after an extended outage, and the LRT's ability to minimize the likelihood and severity of future safety events. TRA will provide, with the team that I noted earlier, appropriate expert and support staff in rail transit operations, maintenance, engineering, competitive contracting, and especially safety. We also provide independent and unbiased assessments, monitoring, and investigations, and report regularly to the City of Ottawa with related findings, recommendations, and audit results. Next slide, please. TRA will also work to assess rail transit industry best practices and whether or not they have been appropriately incorporated as the Confederation line returns to service. As part of our work, we have already started to interview and will continue to interview city, OC Transpo, and contractor personnel to review key derailment investigation reports, analyses, and background information, and to assess and validate the causes and contributing factors that have been identified to date and will be identified going forward with regard to the August 8th and September 9th September 19th derailments. TRA will also review and assess the overall safety management system plans and programs, and will review and assess organizational documents related to vehicle and infrastructure maintenance practices, and will provide monitoring and an assessment of the overall reliability of the system. Next slide, please. And then a final couple of words about our scope of work and work so far. TRA and our team will conduct on-site monitoring during the return to service of the O-Train Confederation Line 1, as well as selective risk-based oversight and auditing during the initial months after return to service. We will provide an independent assessment of the O-Train Confederation Line 1 contractor's safety management system, its safety organization and safety practices, and its integration into the overall project safety management system, especially with a focus on ensuring that the likelihood of future incidents is minimized and to ensure conformance with the overall project safety programs. Next slide, please. With regard to the Safe Return to Service Plan, we have reviewed already and formulated some expectations for what that plan would look like. And this is a summary of those expectations. The team will be looking for a robust investigation of the root cause analyses and the root causes, specific root causes and contributing causes for the August and September derailments. We will be looking specifically for short-term and long-term mitigations that are aligned with those causes. We will look for appropriate repairs and testing to be completed and to be appropriately accounted for on both light rail vehicles, which is to say the trains, and on the right-of-way, the infrastructure elements. We will look closely at the overall Confederation Line's readiness to re-enter service after several weeks out of service. Part of that is ensuring that operators and other key staff are ready for service after several weeks out of service. And finally, we will look for safety systems, quality processes, and staff resources to implement those to minimize the potential for recurrence and future incidents. Next slide, please. A brief overview of our activities to date. We started work on Friday, October 1st. We were on site here the next Sunday, actually the 3rd, but the week of the 4th. We have conducted independent review of contractor root cause analysis documents provided to date. We've conducted several interviews, several document reviews, and field and shop inspections and oversight as recently as yesterday afternoon, actually. We've been engaged in virtually daily meetings regarding the safe return to service process with several different stakeholders and groups. And we've also been in the process of assessing the draft return to service plan elements that have been submitted and that have been available today. Next slide, please. And again, an overview of the deliverables for our work. TRA will provide a recommendation to the city manager as to whether or not to accept or reject the safe return to service plan. As mentioned earlier, we will also provide a technical briefing before service resumes that explains our analysis and our review. We will provide reports on the readiness of the Confederation Line 1 to return to service. We will provide rail transit best practices and analyses relative to Confederation Line practices and to the return to service process as applicable. And also we will provide monitoring and inspection reports to go with the monitoring, auditing, and inspection that I mentioned earlier through the return to service process and in the initial weeks and months of return to service. Next slide, please. That's our presentation. Yep, that's it. That's it for me. Thank you very much.
Is that the end of your presentation, Troy?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. For members of the commission, I've got to let you know we have delegates that will be coming up. There's still some more information we're about to share before we go to delegates, so I would encourage you to lower your hands so that we can ask questions of the delegates, and then we will go to questions of staff. I think at this point, one of the things I want to do is introduce who's all here that will be able to hopefully answer any questions that come up. Sorry, we have our new GM of Transit Services that everybody was introduced to earlier, Renee Amilcar. We also have Brandon Richards, the Chief Safety Officer for Transit. And you just met Ken from TRA. And Ken, you have two vice presidents with you, I believe. Did you want to introduce those two at this time?
Good morning, and thank you. I'm Ken Korak, Kenneth Korak, and I'm the CEO of TRA. Our team actually in Ottawa today is Daniel Haber, who made that presentation, one of our senior vice presidents, and the other senior vice president with us today is Christopher Walgren. And the three of us have been engaged since that Friday, as Dan mentioned, in this evaluation, independent evaluation of the restoration of service plan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ken, and welcome. And then from RTG, RTM, we have Nicholas Turgeon, the CEO of RTG, and Mario Guerrero, the Chief Executive Officer of the Rideau Transit Group Maintenance, who were with us at the last meeting. They rejoined us this time. Thank you both for coming back. Troy and Pat and TRA, thank you for that presentation. I understand that our city manager, Steve Kanellakis, would also like to provide some concluding remarks at this point as well. So, Steve, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just today, we've made available, obviously, TRA, who have a lot of experience, and RTG is here also, in addition to our senior staff. And I want to assure the Transit Commission that we'll stay as long as it takes to answer all the questions and ensure that you get the answers that you feel you require to move forward. We're prepared to do that and to share with you as much information as we can today about the situation and about the return to service. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, City Manager. So next up, we have some members of the public who have signed up to speak. The first speaker is Laura Shantz from Ottawa Transit Riders. Laura, are you there?
Just coming online now, Chair.
Okay.
She may need to accept the prompt to be promoted to panelist.
Okay. The other speaker is Carrie Gwynnis-Elliott from Ottawa Transit Riders as well, if she wants to get ready. Hi, Laura.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you. Go ahead when you're
Excellent.
Ready, please.
Thank you. Just a sec here. Okay, hi, my name is Laura Shantz, and I'm here to speak on behalf of Ottawa Transit Riders. D'abord, je souhaite chaleureusement la bienvenue à Madame Amilcar. J'attends savoir plus vos priorités et j'espère que vous trouvez l'expérience à Ottawa quelque chose d'intéressant. Et c'est plein difficile à ce moment, mais j'espère que tout va bien pour vous. I'm coming here today to speak to the service update. Of note, you know, these documents weren't available in advance. So, and riders have been waiting weeks for a service update on the LRT situation. And while the public's been waiting, they have been providing their own service updates on social media. So Ottawa Transit Riders has been hearing loud and clear that the system is not working as it should and that riders are suffering. So what I've done, as I wasn't able to prepare based on the remarks, is I have decided to let you learn a little bit more about the user experience. I've omitted tweets that are really nasty and mean. I'm not doing a, you know, read mean tweets update, but so as a supplement to the official service update, I would like to enter into the record a quick update from riders. Jean-François Claude tweets, my hashtag mental health has been greatly impacted by transit, as in never better since I last set foot on the Ottawa LRT or bus on March 13th, 2020. Have gained 2+ hours per day not commuting. Hashtag train anxiety can suck it. We have Rob on location saying, I started working from home 5 years ago, well before this, and it has such a positive impact on my life. I save a ton of money plus 2 to 3 hours of commute time a day. I also had a gut feeling this train would not go so well based on how OC Transpo is run. A lot of people are talking about accountability. Jonas Kaufman, him says, we do not need free transit. We need transit to be safe, effective, on time, and reliable, which at present it isn't. Stephanie Carvin tweets, Ottawa, where the city grants everyone free transit on a broken system but will not examine transparency when the system is broken. Hashtag OttLRT, hashtag OttCity. Tyler Meredith says tomorrow, this is from October 12th, Tyler Meredith says tomorrow Ottawa's council has a choice to show residents real leadership to fixing the systemic Ottawa LRT fiasco. It's not about a safety incident or winter. It's a failed P3 that was poorly negotiated and now has zero accountability. Please show us you care at Jim Watson, Ottawa. I'm just going to move on and give some highlights of longstanding frustrations with the system. We know that these are real concerns for a lot of riders. Sally C. Thomas tweets, don't forget the rest of us. Paratranspo hasn't really ever been good and no one gives a crap. I'm paraphrasing slightly. And now because of the LRT gong show, more people need it. Hashtag paraparity at Ottawa Transit Rider. Audrey Moe tweets, seems sadly appropriate that today I am waiting at Tunney's for a bus that's 12 minutes late and counting, or maybe it's just disappeared. Like decency, transparency, and accountability at hashtag Ottawa City Hall. Emma Drake tweets, my favorite things about Ottawa are the reliable and timely trains and buses that definitely allow for social distancing, required masks, and shelter space when waiting. Upside down smiley face, thank you at OC Transpo, hashtag OttLRT. Jay Joseph talks about getting from point A to point B. He says 4 p.m. to 5:20 p.m. transit time today. This is the ordeal of you if you work downtown and live in Bell's Corners. Where is the quality of life at Jim Watson, Ottawa at Aria Canada? Cindy Renon tweets 100% over 2 hours route one way for my daughter to go to high school. Hashtag unacceptable. Jesse tweets, I'm a new mom on maternity leave. I won't go downtown with my newborn right now because I don't want to take him on a crowded R1 bus. I've had to cancel plans because of it. Ali Singh tweets, My commute to my J job has risen 33% to 15 hours a week because of this. Too bad we don't get paid for that time. And I guess just to, one or two more here and then I'll conclude. Crazy Bird at KG Hockey Fan tweets, people with choices are choosing to drive, but the rest of us still need a functioning transit system. And I guess there are a few others about specific times. For example, Brian Murray tweets, from Granville and Montreal Road, it is 2 hours and 32 minutes today, and he's referring to getting to Lansdowne for a sports game. So the reason I brought this to you today is that riders are really not feeling heard in this process. We get that a derailment happened. We get that it's difficult. We understand, but at the same time, we're human beings who have to get from point A to point B. We've got jobs, we've got families, we've got school, we've got responsibilities, and we really feel that we're not being heard. We need a transit system and a transit commission and OC Transpo to understand the user experience in this way. We appreciate when we see counselors tweet out their transit commute. Thank you.
Did you just want to wrap up, Laura?
That would be great. Basically, you know, what I'd like to see is a little more, you know, a little more openness, a few more updates. We'd like to see a little more understanding from our perspective. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for coming out today, Laura. There are some questions for you. Councillor McKinney, please.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair Hubley. Thanks, Laura, for coming back out again today. I know that you are persistent in your strong advocacy for good transit in this city, so I thank you for that. I can't tell you that I've seen every one of those tweets. I've seen many, many messages, much the same. I get them personally sent to me. And you're correct. It's not just around the rail system, the derailment, and, you know, what's occurred as a result of the derailment, but ongoing issues with our system that is underfunded and far too expensive for the average person and for the average family, certainly to move around in the city. And in the last couple of weeks, or last week especially, you know, with RTG refusing to allow the public to see their return to service plan, it reminds me, and this goes to your delegation just now, that they forget, and we forget, that in a P3, one of the P's is public. And it is the public system that is down, that is dysfunctional. It is the public's rail line that we pay, that they paid $2.1 billion for, that we're here today with essentially no real answers. Anyway, we will ask them of RTG later, but I did want to share, Laura, that I also get emails very similar. I had a mom just the other day tell me that some days her kids don't go to school because of the three of them, she can't ensure that they're going to catch the local bus on time to get there on time. She keeps them home. My own daughter, who is always a happy-go-lucky kid, comes home crying many nights now because she spends 3 hours a day on long bus rides. And I hear those stories from many, many residents. So I thank you for coming back out, and I thank you for your ongoing, persistent advocacy in ensuring that we know what's happening out there in the public. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor. Next up is Councillor Gower, please.
Thanks, Chair. Thank you, Laura. I think what you shared from riders should not be a surprise to any councillors or commissioners here. Certainly as a councillor, I see that on social media. I get emails from residents and phone calls as well. But what I wanted to ask you, I mean, you saw the presentation today, how should OC Transpo and the city be communicating the information that we've received today about the what happened and the return to service and the steps? How should we best be communicating that to riders so that they can understand what we've heard here today and what's next?
Well, I think, you know, writers really appreciate having the full information, having, you know, uncensored information as quickly as we can get it. I understand that with the P3, that is really hard to do. That said, the more information, the better. You know, I mean, I was raised, there's a phrase, you know, sunlight is the best, you know, disinfectant, right? Like, it, you know, getting everything out in the open, letting people really understand. I think there's also just, you know, a need for more of a public dialogue and not just a one-way information sharing. You know, I really appreciate that we got the update today. I would have loved to have, you know, more updates along the way. I know, you know, friends, you know, tweeted out pictures, texted me photos of, you know, the train tracks being replaced. It would be really interesting as these things happen if riders could understand what's going on and why. I know that's tough with the privacy, but it's really about real-time communication so people understand what's going on, where we are in the process of getting back on the rails. I saw a lot of that today. I appreciate what I saw. And it's really about, you know, moving forward in that spirit of transparency to the best of our abilities, because that's what riders need. They need to know that this is a system that we all take seriously, that we can trust, that we can have confidence in, and providing them as much information as possible, as quickly as possible, in my mind, is the best way to do that.
Okay, thanks, Laura. You know, Mr. Turgeon and Mr. Guerra are here. And if one of my colleagues doesn't beat me to it, I'll be asking them about releasing that return to service plan publicly. We do have a summary in front of us today, which is good, but I understand why it's important to residents and riders to have as much detail as possible. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor. Next up is Councillor Deans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Laura, for being here. I don't have a question. I just wanted to say thank you for keeping this experience real for us and reminding us of the everyday impact on our transit customers, of the situation that we find ourselves in. I can tell you, my constituents are keeping me well informed about the everyday impact, as I'm sure all of my colleagues are hearing the same thing. So there are real impacts to people every day that this system is down, and we need to be aware of the hardship that this is creating. So thank you for being here and reminding of us of that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Deans. Next up is Commissioner Wright Gilbert, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Laura, thank you so much for being here, for continuing to be an advocate. We need voices such as yours to be at these meetings and to be out in the public to really represent the riders, the real people who are experiencing this system every single day, the good, the bad, and the definitely ugly of some of it. I wanted to add, I've seen most of the tweets that you mentioned. As you may know, I spend a little bit of time on Twitter, just a little. But I wanted to add two perspectives, actually, to what you've given to us. And thank you for that summary. That was comprehensive. First perspective is, yesterday I received an email from a mom, a new mom here in Ottawa, not going to use her name. And it was about her concerns with respect to the safety of our LRT system. And she's so worried about her kids. She has two kids that are older, that are in their early teens, that take the LRT system essentially and the transit system across the city to go to school every day. And she also has a new baby. Her email moved me basically to tears. And so I called her. Never done that before as a citizen commissioner, but I called her and I talked to her for nearly an hour. And there were several points in the phone call where both of us were very, very close to tears. Her concerns are about this overall safety of our LRT system, of those trains, how she as a mother can really get right in her mind with putting her children on a train that she fundamentally does not necessarily believe is safe. I don't think that her concerns are a one-off. I think many parents in this city have those very similar concerns about possibly putting their children in danger on our train. So our job as counselors and commissioners and OC Transpo staff and RTG is to, and TRA, because we've hired them, welcome, by the way, is, as you said, through sunlight and transparency, and accountability, that is how we are going to convince our ridership that this system is safe and is going to work for them. The other perspective I want to add really quickly is my own. So as most people know, prior to the pandemic, I'm a federal public servant, so I'm working from home at the moment. I use transit to get to work every single day. I can tell you that because I changed jobs during the pandemic, if I have to go back to the office, even though my new job is literally one stop away from Tiny's Pasture, it's near Westboro Station. My commute is going to now be, on good days, an hour and a half just to get to my job. It will involve me driving to the Orleans Park and Ride, getting on the bus to get to the train, getting on the train, riding it from start to finish, getting off the train, walking all the way around the loop at Tunney's Pasture to the end, and then waiting for a bus that only comes every half an hour to then get to my job. And I'm just going to say this right here and right now. Yes, I do get a free transit pass as a result of being a transit commissioner. I will not be using it when the pandemic is over and when I am going back to the office. I don't have 3 hours a day to waste on commuting. I will be, unfortunately, taking my car, because in terms of work-life balance and you know, mental health, I can't spend 3 hours a day commuting. That's on a good day. I just can't do it. And so I wanted to add my perspective as a transit rider. Yes, I'm a transit commissioner, but I'm also a transit rider, and I will no longer be using our service because it doesn't work for me. And yes, I acknowledge my privilege that I have a vehicle and can afford a parking pass and can use it. So I wanted to add my perspective.
1 minute.
And thank you. My perspective and the perspective of the individual I spoke with yesterday, because these are real concerns and I want everyone to hear them and not just when I tweet about them. Thank you again, Laura. And I hope to see you soon. Thanks for coming. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hey, thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Laura, for your presentation. Next up is Carrie Glennis Elliott, please. Do you see her there, Eric?
There you go. I'm here.
Oh, just perfect.
Took me a moment with the tech. So hi, I want to say a warm welcome to our new manager, Renee Amilcar. I hope I've pronounced your name correctly. My name is Carrie Glynes Elliott, and I'm also from the Ottawa Transit Riders. I submitted my question to the Transit Commission. I don't know whether everybody's got a copy, but as a member of the Ottawa Transit Riders, we actually have two requests of the Transit Commission, because one of our frustrations is that it's a little bit challenging. Hold on a moment. Francis, could you just freeze while I'm doing this, please? It's very loud. Sorry. So I have two requests of the Transit Commission regarding transit. This presentation was very, very interesting, but we didn't hear anything about paratranspo, which is a responsibility of the Transit Commission. And we are asking that questions about paratranspo or updates about paratranspo be added as a standing item to all Transit Commission meetings moving forward. A lot of our members use paratranspo. They had questions and concerns and problems before the train launched. They had problems before the pandemic began. They have problems during the pandemic, and they have really no way of coming to City Council in any way, shape, or form to say, we have questions about things like capacity. We have questions about mask mandates and policies around masks and things like that. So that is one of our requests, is that an update on paratranspo be added to the agenda moving forward. Our second request, and I realize that this is a bit of a challenge, is to draft a much more comprehensive, possibly radical plan for improving our one service when the train is down. We don't think that hoping that the train is going to be 100% in 2 weeks is really much of a plan. As you heard from Laura and as you heard from Sarah and from a lot of other people, R1 service is incredibly frustrating. And I heard Troy Charter's presentation, and I heard him say there's nothing we can do. And I think there are things we can do if we break it down into small problems and fix solutions. Some of the suggestions that we would like is an exploration of whether we can extend the transfer window. If it's taking people 2 hours to get places, and it's not their problem. It's the problem that OC Transport service isn't adequate. I don't think they should be having to pay extra because the service is so long. So we would like an exploration of expanding the transfer window. We'd also like both the city and OC Transpo to explore dedicated bus lanes. We realize that increasing capacity is going to be extremely difficult at such short notice, although maybe long-term plans is something we look at. But if we're going to use our limited resources more efficiently, one of the best things to do is dedicated bus lanes. I'm not talking permanent, I'm talking when the R1 service is in. So we'd like that exploration. The third thing that we would like some sort of debate over is a lot of people have been talking about reinstating some of the pre-LRT bus routes. The 95 keeps being mentioned. It was a great bus, a real workhorse bus. It ran east-west every few minutes, and it was very, very functional. I realize that once the train is up and running and really reliable, it won't be necessary, but it may be a very, very good idea to think about reinstating a few of those routes. So those are the two requests from the Ottawa Transit Riders. I really do hope that you consider that. Thank you for giving me the time to speak. As I said, the Ottawa Transit Riders tries as much as possible to be a voice of transit riders, and right now everybody is screaming.
Thank you, Carrie. There's a couple of questions for you, so if you don't mind holding on a moment. Councillor Kavanaugh, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, Carrie, for coming out today. In terms of paratranspo, and I'm thinking in terms of this is about equity to transit, and have they approached the advisory committee on accessibility that the city has?
Yes, some of our members are members of that group or they have spoken to it. But when they're speaking specifically about transit issues, quite often they get told this isn't the right committee for it. You need to go to talk to the Transit Commission. So what I'm saying is that just as having it as a standing item, this is an update on paratranspo. You can be talking about the online booking. You can be talking about new apps. There's good news coming down the pipeline. Some demands of customers are starting to be realized. But there are also questions that are transit specific. And so the other committee doesn't really help.
Okay, I appreciate that. And I don't mind having that on the agenda. I mean, if there's good news to report, then that's an opportunity as well. And it also gives us a chance to ask questions specifically about it so we don't skip it over. So I think we could, personally, I think that would be something we could look at for sure.
That's good.
So thank you. And in terms of equity, and I could have asked this to Laura as well. I look at gender equity, the gender lens. Do you see that as an issue as well in terms of
Oh, yes. I mean, lots of studies. I used to be a gender analyst, and a lot of studies on transit concern that the majority of transit users are women, and a lot of transit users are parents, young parents. I know I didn't have a car when my children were little, and I went everywhere with my small children. So, yes, any kind of transit issue is related to gender and also age and also regarding disability. The danger, I think, is that we don't get into the situation where we sort of think some people pay for transit and other people use it. So it's kind of a transfer. We're all really in this together. And when transit is very, very poor, everybody suffers. So nobody benefits whatsoever from bad transit. So I'm a little bit reluctant to go into pitting one group of people against another if some people read it that way.
Yeah, no, and that's not the intention. It's an analysis and of who's using it and how we can make it better for them. I appreciate that very much, Carrie.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Councillor. Next up is Councillor McKenney for questions of delegation, please.
Yes, thanks, Chair. Thanks, Carrie, for coming out again, advocating for the needs of the public, of people who ride transit. Just a quick question for you. I know that you are involved, with transit groups, transit users. In terms of the service that's being provided today, especially with the Confederation Line 1 down, R1 service, and then the impacts on other lines and other bus routes, rather. Do you think that that we have enough buses? Do you think that it's just a matter of communicating better, telling you we won't show up, or do you, in your assessment of how our transit is working today, feel that we just don't have the capacity to operate a full transit system that will meet the needs of the public?
In my assessment, we didn't have the capacity before the train was launched, and the train was expected to improve that. The problem is that it's very, very difficult to increase capacity over a short period of time, particularly if we think it's going to be temporary because the train will eventually catch up. And so I have long been an advocate of much better communication. I am the new manager is here somewhere. I have to say that the lack of communication about buses that are canceled or late is salt in the wounds for anybody who's standing there trying to figure out how to navigate our system. And improving communication would probably be the cheapest and fastest way to reduce frustration across the system. The other thing, as I said, is if we have limited capacity, and we currently do have limited capacity, we have to look at ways of being way more efficient. And I'm looking at the R1 routes and seeing as how they loop around and they're inefficient, and I'm seeing them stuck in traffic and things like that. And I think while the R1 is running, we have to just absolutely clear the deck and make it really, really easy for these R1 buses to get around. We could, in fact, run a bit of a study. Next week, ask the drivers to count how long it takes them to get from point A to point B driving their R1 buses, and then put temporary dedicated bus lanes up and count again. I mean, this is a really simple research study. I think that if we have limited capacity, and that's what it looks like to me, having listened to the complaints for years and years, we need to be a lot more strategic in how we use the resources we currently have.
Thank you. And yeah, absolutely. Over the medium and long term, we do have to. Today, I am concerned about our capacity just to meet the basic needs of our ridership today. But no, I hear you. There's a lot more that we can be doing.
Can I also say that capacity at paratranspo is an issue?
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Again, when you have the train go down, the train was very, very accessible. It does mean that people who would have used the train are now going to paratranspo, which really, really puts more stress on the paratranspo system. And as winter comes, that also has an effect. And that, the capacity of paratranspo hasn't been discussed at all. That was a problem before the pandemic and is going to be a problem when we're all back as well.
Absolutely. And thank you for bringing that up, because you're correct. And we said that, you know, the train will provide more accessibility to people who, you know, because it is so accessible to, you know, get on and off the train. So thank you for raising that. It's something that we can't forget. Thanks, Carrie. Okay. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Councillor. Next up is Councillor Leeper, please.
Thanks, Carrie, for the presentation. Good to see you. I think it was a couple of weeks ago, I'm losing track of time. I did raise at a meeting the potential to, for example, close Rideau Street to anyone but buses. It's a real bottleneck. What are some of the other bottleneck streets that you're seeing?
The downtown core is absolutely a mess with transit when it really gets stuck. But also out near Tunney's Pasture, the sort of the Scott Street area is pretty rough as well. I personally would leave it up to OC Transpo. I really am not trying to be an outsider and say, OC Transpo, you must make a dedicated lane here or a dedicated lane here. I would really like somebody to do a bit of research on where the bottlenecks are and be really, really proactive in creating, again, even if it's only temporary, dedicated bus lanes. Because as far as I can see, pretty much all transit experts are adamant that this is the single best way of making your buses more efficient. And again, if we're not able to buy more buses and hire more staff, we need to figure out how to use our current resources well. Right now, we're not doing that. And so dedicated bus lanes are really cheap and really easy. You can take them up, you can put them up, take them down. I mean, I know it's not the simplest thing in the world, but it's a lot simpler than building permanent transit waste runs or anything of the other options that are out there. It's a very straightforward thing to do. And I really do think the city and OC Transpo should be considering it.
I know OC Transpo has the data. They know how long it takes every trip to get from point A to point B. I would be interested in hearing specific suggestions, though, just as I continue to follow up with OC. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Councillor. And finally, Councillor Fleury, and then we'll get to questions of staff after this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Carrie, I wasn't going to jump in, but when you spoke of the R1 and various considerations, I felt compelled to. So I know that one of the most challenging areas is for buses going northbound, going towards Rideau Street. I know you haven't gone to the transit rider group, so I'm asking you as a person, do you feel that the R1 would be better served in these situations for longer term flow to use Mackenzie Bridge?
I'm afraid that I'm not in a position to really answer that. I think that OC Transpo is probably in a better answer. I think that's a great question. I have to admit that I'm working at home these days, and so I am not out and about on the buses as much as I was when I started this group. And so previously I was able to say, in my experience, I saw this and this is what I would like to do. I really do think that, as Councillor Leeper said, OC Transport has the data. They know where the bottlenecks are. What I'm saying is that they need to be a little bit more ambitious in providing better service when the R1 service, because the transit riders have suffered an awful lot, and it's not their fault that the train is derailed. So that's kind of my argument. I wish I could give you a better answer, and I know exactly what you're asking, but other than going back to my members and asking, I can't answer that question.
Okay. I know OC Transpo was in a bit of a bizarre spot, right, because we do want regular proximity to Rideau LRT. But Rideau was not designed, the latest design, which I like, wide sidewalks, narrower street, are not designed for a transitway. And the R1 runs as a transitway. So Mackenzie Bridge is actually a better flow for it. So I'll take that on with OC. But I know that one of OC's questions is ridership experience and proximity to Rideau Station. So that remains kind of that. You risk one factors by moving it off one route. So, but appreciate your intervention today, and I'll be following up with OC.
Right.
Okay, thank you, Carrie, for your presentation coming out today. We appreciate that. There's no other questions, so we're going to move to questions of staff. So now's the time to get all the hands up. Great. We'll start with Commissioner Wright Gilbert, but before we start, Commissioner, if you could just allow me to check. Is the Vice Chair there? Councillor Cloutier, are you on? Councillor Cloutier? Okay, we'll try to track him down. Okay, go ahead, Commissioner Wright Gilbert.
I mean, if you need to step away, Chair,
I am here.
Happy. There he is.
There he is. Okay, Vice Chair, would you mind taking over for a couple of moments? I have to make a phone call.
Noted. Thank you.
Thank you.
The list I have, we are on questions to staff. Commissioner Wright Gilbert, I believe.
Is
that correct? Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. So first question is actually just a general question. TRA's, we've heard that TRA is going to give a technical briefing prior to the relaunch of Line 1. Will citizen commissioners be invited to that technical briefing?
Mr. Chair, the technical briefing will be open to council, commissioners, media, whoever wants to come and attend.
Great. Thank you, Mr. City Manager. So I'm going to start. I have a few areas of questions. So the first area is about the wheel slips, the wheel slip warnings. We talked a little bit about this the last Transit Commission meeting with respect to the August derailment. And Mr. Charter and I exchanged some emails. I did let Mr. Charter know about my question prior to this meeting, just so he'd have the information. And he did provide me the information ahead of time. I'm just wanting it to be public. So can we just confirm that obviously in the hours leading up to the August derailment, there were wheel slip warnings. We've seen that in the TSB report, but in the time leading up to the September derailment, were there any wheel slip warnings or error messages received?
Mr. Chair, I can answer that question. In the time leading up to the September 19th derailment, there were some, it's called wheel slip movements that were observed. But so that is part of the ongoing investigation. So I just wanted, if I could back up a little bit and clarify that, you know, the trains are equipped with sensors that pick up any sort of a wheel slip or traction, you know, when there's momentary loss of traction, sort of like, you know, the traction control you'd have in your car. It's not an error code, but it gets coded in the vehicle's diagnostic. So whenever there's a request for additional traction, the sensors pick that up, and then they tell the sander systems to dispel some sand on the track to give it some traction. So that's normal behavior of the train. What RTG had set up was, because they observed it following their investigation to the August 8th derailment, was that that train was observed, was experiencing some longer requests for sand. And that was viewed as potentially an indicative of, you know, there was an issue with the axle bearing. You know, we should remove that train from service right away. So they set up an alert notification process that their technicians would be advised, and then they could advise OC Transpo to remove the train from service. It was meant to as a supplemental tool to the ongoing vehicle inspections that I talked about. So part of the investigation of the September 19th derailment is going to look at, you know, what happened with that notification. And my understanding, which is still subject to confirmation, is that it was experiencing some of those requests for traction, those slip slides, but it wasn't at the length that they experienced prior, you know, in the August one. And, you know, it was viewed that was a potential normal behavior, but that needs to be thoroughly investigated, and it's part of the ongoing investigation. But to answer your question, yes, the vehicle diagnostics did pick up those requests for sand, those requests for traction in the time leading up to the derailment.
Thank you. Thank you for that additional context. I appreciate it. So from how I understand this, these warnings, messages, wheel slip messages, these don't get sent to the ERO or the driver in real time, correct?
Yeah, that is correct, Mr. Chair.
And they do not go to the rail operations center in real time either, correct?
That is correct. These messages are part of the ongoing vehicle diagnostics. So there's a number of you know, diagnostic information in there, whether it's traction control, whether it's braking, brake rates, passenger emergency intercoms. You know, so when there's events, you know, the Alstom technicians can go in, download the vehicle diagnostics, and really start to assess and see what happens. So they were able to determine a potential pattern as following the August 8th derailment. But you're correct. That information does not go to the operator, and it does not go to our Transit Operations Control Center. It is, you know, part of our ongoing review as to what other tools and mitigations can we put in place to prevent these things from happening. So that is part of the ongoing assessment, is what additional things that can we put in place to prevent these things from reoccurring.
Okay. So just make sure I understand this correctly. These slip side, these wheel slip messages, we'll just call them that because I keep getting it wrong. These wheel slip messages are essentially a precursor. They're a warning that the wheels are not getting the traction that they need. And as we saw with the August derailment and possibly with the September derailment, subject to further investigation, they are a warning, a precursor to possible derailment. Correct?
Commissioner and Mr. Chair, that is correct. But there are a number of operational reasons in which that are perfectly normal that, you know, a train would request sand, you know, so you have events, you know, and I appreciate this wasn't the situation for both derailments, but there are a number of occurrences such as, you know, when you have slippery or wet conditions due to snow or frost, you know, even on when trains are going up hills and those types of things, or sometimes even when they're just departing a station, there's a request for traction. So there's a number of operational reasons, but this is perfectly normal behavior. And so when this alert was put into place, it was thought, you know, it could result in some false positives, meaning we could be pulling some trains from service that are perfectly fine, but let's err on the side of caution and have those trains inspected. But to your point, you know, the alert that was set up was intended to try to capture these things in advance. And, you know, as I said, add an extra layer of protection to try to prevent these things from occurring.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you for that additional context. But just to be clear, the answer to my question was yes, it is a precursor to problems and potentially a derailment. So just so I understand correctly, these error codes, messages, whatever, they don't get sent to anyone in real time. They're essentially held in the black box of the train, for lack of a better term, correct?
Yeah, there are a number of operational reasons in which, and there's many diagnostic information that goes straight to the Altium technicians, but you are correct. The information, though, was set up as an alert notification system, but it does not go to the operator, and it does not go directly to our operators in the control center.
Right. So if these warning messages really are kind of the only warning messages or slip slide messages, whatever we're going to call them, that there is a potential problem and a potential derailment on the horizon, what's the point of the sensors if the information from that sensor is not available to the operator, nor is it available to the rail operations center? These are the very people who could prevent an ensuing catastrophe. What is the point of this sensor if they don't have that information?
You know, Mr. Chair, you know, I can provide a bit of an answer to that, and maybe I can ask Mr. Guerra to elaborate. But, you know, it's important to keep in mind that this is all part of the vehicle diagnostics. The team got, looked at the information as a result of the August 8th derailment, and we're looking at what other tools could we use. The speed sensors and the traction sensors, they're not intended for, you know, the operator or the control center to be using it to assess whether or not a vehicle is safe and reliable service. That's what the inspection regime is to ensure that. And, you know, we've got to keep in mind that we want the operator focused on, you know, on driving the train, watching the platforms, ensuring that, you know, everything's clear from a safe and keep the service moving in that way. And from a safe and secure perspective, it wasn't intended, all these diagnostics aren't intended to be communicated directly to the operator. And as I mentioned before, there's probably hundreds, if not thousands, of different types of diagnostics that are kept within the vehicle's onboard computer. And then that Altium technicians can access to assess, should they need to.
So I get all that, and I understand that. But here's my issue. And perhaps I'm not being clear, and I apologize if that's the case. There's a difference between minor diagnostics and a warning message, whatever we're going to call it, about wheel slippage, which clearly can indicate that there is a possibility of derailment or problem with the train. There's a difference between those two things. It seems to be that this error message is our only indication of a derailment that could be impending. And so my issue is that, and I understand that we can't have a million messages going to operators, and I do understand that while the train is in motion, the operator's message screen goes blank, and they can only review those messages when they're at a station. But we do have an entire rail operations center who can monitor these things. And so my point is, if we have a warning message, that is essentially the only way we are going to know if a train is about to derail, possibly, and it's not going in, these messages are not going in real time to anybody and are instead in the black box of the train and then can be downloaded as a data dump by Alstom. And it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Charter, that Alstom and RTG actually own this information and are not required to provide it to OC Transpo. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I mean, the one thing I do want to just back up again and say, you know, it's not, these aren't warning or error codes. This is, you know, it's what's recorded is a request as a result of a traction issue, a request to dispel sand to assist with the traction, which is normal behavior. That's the primary function of these systems and the diagnostics. But, you know, as I mentioned, we are looking at, part of the ongoing investigation is looking at, so obviously what happened in this case, but more importantly, can those notifications be given directly to the operator, to the control center, but as well, what other actions, what other containment, what other mitigations we can put in place that don't necessarily rely on this. There may be other things. So, you know, the TSB is referenced, thermal hot bearing detections. So we're looking at all those systems, including, you know, this notification potentially to either a control center or our operator.
Troy, can I just ask, because, you know, I get where the commissioner is going with this, and I want to make sure that we don't leave the impression a wrong impression, and I don't know the answer, and I'm going to ask if there's a causal relationship between wheel slippage and possible prediction of derailment. I think that's the question, and whether those warnings actually would assist in predictability around that. And I'd like TRA to, if they could jump in and opine on whether, from their expertise, if whether that's the case.
Is that Mr. Harbour who would pick up on that?
Yeah, I can take a first go at that, and Ken or Chris, if you want to add anything, certainly please do. I think at this point, based on the information that we have, I would want to know a little bit, dive into a little bit deeper the slip slide notifications and how those are used on the LRV and on the train. But from my experience with similar slip slide detection on other trains, I think it's certainly it's good information maybe after the fact when there's been a derailment or there's been an incident. I do think about it as being similar to maybe the anti-lock brake system on my car or the traction control system on a car, where those things may come into play for a variety of reasons, but don't necessarily act as good predictors of an accident or good predictors of a collision going forward. So I think it's useful information, and certainly I would agree with Mr. Charter. I think that one of the things that we're very interested in is whether that information should be looked at differently going forward based on what we've learned with these two derailments. But I think that useful, but not necessarily something I would think of as a derailment warning system or a necessarily strongly linked to the possibility of derailment.
You would agree with me that if on your car your traction control system turns off, which does sometimes happen, or your anti-lock brake warning light comes up saying that you no longer have ABS, that you would take some sort of proactive action to fix that. And number two, that may cause you to change your driving behavior, if we're going to continue the analogy. And my point is that if we have a message system that could alert us to the fact that there may be a problem with the, especially on a fair weather day where there's no rain and there's no snow and there's no leaves on the tracks or whatever, I'm sure you would agree with me that if we have these messages available to us, that there is a value to those messages being available in real time to perhaps the rail operations center or whomever, rather than going to the black box. That is the point that I am making in terms of looking backwards with respect to this derailment. The fact that this information, even though we knew it after the August derailment, that was warning signs in the 5 hours prior to that derailment, we knew that. And those messages continue to go to a black box, essentially a black hole, that is only downloadable by Alstom technicians and is data that is owned by RTG and therefore not necessarily available to the City of Ottawa and the Rail Operations Center. That is the point that I am making and drawing an inference from. This, we need to look at all of the things, and not me, I'm not a technician. You all, the people we've hired, the people that we pay $5 million a month to, need to look at all of these things so that we can keep our passengers safe. That is what I am trying to bring out here. Sorry, Mr. Clerk, Deputy Clerk Eric, sorry, how much time do I have?
You're actually out of time, Commissioner.
Oh, well, thank you. I will come back for another round. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Wright Gilbert. And if you'd like to come back on, of course. Thank you. Commissioner Caricato, please.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for your presentations and welcome, Renee. I look forward to working with you and getting to know you better. I saw your interviews in the media yesterday, and in particular, I'm looking forward to your technical solutions to our real technical issues that you pointed out, and I look forward to your experience and different point of view. So I've got a couple of different questions. One is about the R1 and the other one is more about the return to service. So perhaps I'll start with the R1 questions to get them out of the way. And I think our public delegation, the second one, mentioned this as well. Since we know issues will likely occur again, hopefully not, but if they do, are we coming up with a more concrete R1 replacement strategy that can be launched immediately so we're not scrambling after the fact, kind of like we are today? Maybe that's a question for Pat.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One of the many things that was done in preparation for the line opening was to set a plan for replacement bus service to be put in place in case of any delay or any closure of the line. And so that was part of one of our many operational things that we had to do before the line opened. And that's how we decided on how what we eventually called the R1 replacement bus service would operate. We then modified that based on experience when bad things happened on the line over the first few months in 2019 and into that winter of 1920, and came up with the basic layout that we implemented back on September 19th and 20th. We then, as I mentioned earlier, we made a number of improvements since then to sort of streamline the route, particularly at Sevierville Station and providing the direct to downtown trips. The difficulties come more on the east end of the route than on the west end of the route. On the west end, Scott Street, Albert Street, Queen Street, all very well parallel the route and parallel where the stations are. Once we get past Rideau Street, the Ottawa station is not at a location where people can walk to Nicholas Street. Lee's station is not at a place that people can walk to the highway. Herdman Station is similarly off the highway. And Sevierville Station is very hard to get to without taking a long path through other streets to get there. So that's why we run the direct, in the rush hour, direct bypass routes, trips from Blair to bypass all those intermediate stations. We've looked the month we've been in this situation, we've looked carefully and more than once at each of the stations across the line. Is there a way to serve those customers equally well without imposing such long travel times on the other customers, the ones who aren't traveling to that stop? It's an axiom. It's just inevitable that there's always more people traveling than are going to the next stop. Most people on the bus are not going to the next stop on the route, and that's always true, except in a very, very short route. So the number of people who are interested in going to Lee's is always smaller than the number of people who aren't interested in going to Lee's. The number of people who are interested in going to Pimasy is always smaller than The number of people who are interested in going to Pimasy is always smaller than the number of people who are not interested in going to Pimasy. So we need to balance that out and see what is the benefit to customers of serving that stop, what is the inconvenience to those customers of bypassing that stop. For the customers who aren't traveling to that point, what's the benefit to them of bypassing that stop, and what's the inconvenience to them of continuing to serve that stop? So if we take Rideau Station as the example, we could bypass Rideau Station by having the buses all run on another street, such as Mackenzie King Bridge, and that would speed up travel time for anyone traveling between University of Ottawa or East and Parliament or West. But what it would do is, for everyone who is going to Rideau Station, give them a longer walk, because they'd have to walk to the Rideau Centre, through the Rideau Centre, if they're going somewhere north of Rideau Street, as most of our customers are at that location. So we do that analysis at each station across the line and make the conclusions and come to the conclusions that we have, which is what has shaped the service that we're running today.
So what you're saying is we have a plan, we're following the plan, and we're just continuing to amend it as we learn more and, you know, as we can determine more ways to get faster service. Is that right?
I would say that we might have made different decisions had we not been during the pandemic. but on the equally, we wouldn't, you know, the current frequency of service would have been by no means adequate to carry our regular number of customers if the pandemic hadn't been on. With the pandemic on, we know that our travel patterns downtown are not exactly the same as they would be without. There's not as many office workers going. So service workers, people who are going to and from retail, people who are going to and from schools, universities, and colleges are making up a greater fraction of our total ridership than they would normally. That would tell us, you know, better, more important for us to serve places like Rideau Street and the University of Ottawa and King Edward than normally in proportion, because it's less important to serve places like the DND office up against King Bridge or the many federal offices through downtown. So we've adapted. We're running a different service right now than we would have if the pandemic were not in place, if we had a normal distribution of work. So obviously we need to adapt the plan to the circumstance, but the plan appears to us to be the best possible in the circumstance to serve most customers at their normal service point, which is at the bus stop as close as we can get it to the station entrance, and to give customers the information and the, you know, the stability and the confidence that that's where they'll get their bus every day. That's where it'll drop them off in the morning. That's where they'll pick them up in the afternoon. The other thing I'll add to this is, of course, our colleagues in traffic services are very closely aligned with our people in planning and in control center. And we're working with them to, they monitor the traffic levels at all points, that they can change the timing on traffic signals where required to give the buses a head start.
Okay. In addition to, you know, the lack of buses or insufficient buses, do we have enough operators?
Well, currently we have the number of buses and operators that we're running. It's a matter of judgment and opinion whether it's enough. If we had more, we could do more. But from everything we see, we know there's inconvenience to everyone. Everyone's having a longer wait and a longer travel time than they would have if the train were running or if we had more buses. But we know that we are moving all the people. We're not having continuing capacity problems where we have overloads on individual trips. It's usually the result of that bus being a few minutes late. So following that gap, it just carries more people. And the people who have the confidence that there's another bus coming a few minutes later can wait for that next bus, and people are moving through. But we know that there are overcrowding problems when a particular bus gets held up at a particular point. And then, you know, we work to fill that gap further down the route and, you know, get the buses back evenly spaced by the time they're making the next trip.
Okay, thanks. I'll move on now to the return to service part of my questions. And I want to zero in a bit on the thermal monitoring that's come up a bit following the August derailment. And perhaps this is a question for TRA, since you're here to sort of assess our entire system and look at, you know, rail transit industry best practices, as you mentioned, and whether they're properly incorporated. In your view, is the thermal monitoring something that should have been considered prior to the launch on our trains? Because I understand it wasn't something that we required of Alstom, but yet it would have been a nice to have as opposed to a must have. Is that current, you know, best practice across other sectors, or is that something we should have looked a bit more at the time?
I think for my part, again, I'll let Chris or Ken weigh in with any additional information that they might have. I do not know of any other light rail systems that we have worked with that have thermal bearing monitoring on the vehicles, as has been discussed as part of this project. And I do not know of any light rail systems that use a wayside thermal bearing detection system that's commonly used on railroads. Now, Ken or Chris, if you have anything else you want to add to that.
No, that's correct.
Okay. That's good to know. Have you, TRA, been given access to the reports from the 12-day testing period that we did before we launched in September 2019?
I don't think that we've seen those yet. I don't know that we had requested those on our end. Chris, do you remember if those were any of the documents that we went through?
No, I don't recall seeing those, but they have been transparent with sharing documentation with us upon request. So we certainly could make that request and look at it.
That'd be good. I'm just trying to see if there's anything that came up during that time that, you know, could have led to a different outcome than where we are today. And, you know, that'll be important as we move into stage 2 and 3 of light rail in our city.
Yes, and we've certainly looked at hazard analyses initially developed for the project. So we'll look further into that.
Great, thanks. And then Mr. Charter, during your presentation, you mentioned that the city will take 1 to 2 days of testing before making a final decision. And 1 to 2, like it's 1 or 2 or both, you know, is that enough? And maybe you can all weigh in on this, TRA and Mr. Charter as well. And how did you come up with 1 to 2 days instead of 10 days or 5 days?
Hey, Mr. Chair, maybe I'll take a first crack at the response and then I'll turn it over to TRA at that point. The 1 to 2 days is right now is just a guideline. We need to see what the detailed return to work plan is, and that assessment's ongoing. We anticipated that we know that we want to do some testing. We want to run trains for a period of time. Is 1 day enough? Is 2 days enough? Does it need to be longer? You know, that will be informed through the process that we're going through right now. And if the recommendation is that we should go longer, we will. But the point here is we just wanted to make sure that we highlighted that there will be a period of time in which we're running trains prior to, you know, as part of a, you know, final check and balance, but prior to we start back in service picking up customers. Turn it over to TRA at this point.
Thanks. I would agree with what Mr. Charter said. I think that the testing period is largely dependent on the final form of the return to service plan. The only other part that I would add comes to mind for me, as I mentioned in our presentation, is our expectation is that there will be a certain amount of testing with regard to the vehicles and infrastructure as well, which will be happening between now and that period that I think that Troy had in mind. So there are maybe a couple of different layers of testing that I would expect to see that are complementary and perhaps prerequisites to the larger testing.
And that
I would just
go ahead.
I would just add that we asked the same question, which is put the justification behind the proposed test period. How is that tied back to standards? How is that tied back to the practice of initial service testing and what methods you'll use? So we expect to see that laid out for us so we can assess that.
Okay, and I hope that'll be part of our technical briefing prior to the launch. I mean, I don't have to come here today to tell you all that we have a lack of confidence in the system. And I think giving riders and citizens at large that kind of, I guess, predictability or knowing, you know, it's going to go through a rigorous 5 day or 10 day or 2 days based on best practices, based on the issues you've identified, will give us some more, I guess, confidence that it is being rigorously tested before we decide to proceed and have passengers back on those trains. So just like the 12-day period before we launched in 2019, we all knew it was very clear that we needed to do 12 days of testing. And if anything went wrong during those 12 days, we had to restart from day one. So if you guys, when you're making your recommendation to the city, can include that and provide justification like you just mentioned, I think that would go a long way to providing us and ultimately our riders more confidence that rigorous testing is being done, and avoid 1 or 2 days. Be very clear and explain why it's 5 days or 10 days or however many days. And just so I understand, it'll be TRA that makes the recommendation on the number of days that the city will do its own testing after RTG is done. Did I get that right? Left.
25 seconds left.
Someone can answer.
I can speak just quickly to my understanding of it is that the testing that I mentioned with respect to vehicles and infrastructure will come as a recommendation from the contractor, which we will weigh in on the appropriateness of that. And then we have also started to review training, recertification, the elements that are required for OC Transpo's part to get back into service. And so we will review OC Transpo's recommendation for what that their part of testing, what their part of testing prior to service should look like.
But ultimately, the decision will be made by RTG or OC Transpo.
I think both with respect to the parts that they are respectively responsible for.
Okay, thanks. That's all my questions. Yeah,
if you raised a good question, I just want to point out that if at any point in the return to service testing, we see a problem or an issue, we will certainly alert folks to that. And if we think we need to restart, or we think there's a significant issue, we're going to identify that. And make sure that we're clear on that, since our role is to be independent of both parties in here to make sure that it's being done. And just to clarify one element, the concept behind what I'll call the pre-certification, the return to service testing, is to see that all the different parts work closely together and they're working as designed as an integrated system. Because the rail line hasn't been running for a while, you have the operator side, you have the infrastructure side, you have the vehicle side. There's lots of individual component testing that's going on as part of the return to service. Part of this whole idea of running up the pre-revenue service without passengers is to make sure all the different parts of the kit work well together and as designed.
If I could add to that, Councillor, too, I think it may be helpful. I think it might be able to answer your question. The testing, and it's been communicated to the contractor, is determined upon a risk-based approach, and that means that we take all the elements of the root causes that are identified, the corrective actions, and incorporate, similar to what Ken's saying, all those intricate pieces to the plan to make sure that it flows and works together in a way that we reduce our risk to the lowest possible level before we can enter back into service. And the testing's got to make sure that all those elements are followed through and carried through correctly.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. That's all my questions.
I see that the chair is back, and so I will turn it back over to him to chair the meeting. But I do just want to advise all commissioners that apparently Councillor Gower got knocked off. And so he is, in fact, in line between Councillor Commissioner Brockington and Commissioner McKinney. I just want to advise the chair of that and all members who are asking questions.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair. So next up is Commissioner Olson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to get into the issue of the improperly torqued bolt, I guess the root cause of the September derailment. And it occurs to me, it's the old proverb, for the want of a nail, the kingdom was lost. And it just seems like a very odd problem, and a very minute problem, to actually shut down the entire LRT for 6 to 8 weeks. And I'd like first to ask Mr. Korak, are you aware, or your staff, of course, Mr. Hubbard, Mr. Walgren, are you aware of any other instance where improperly torqued bolts led to the shutdown of an LRT for an extended period?
Well, it's a good question. And I can't at this point just say I can identify a system where they shut down because of an improperly torqued bolt. I can tell you, though, in my 40 plus years of experience, that the proper torquing of bolts has been a significant issue and has resulted in either unsafe conditions or derailments or other factors that have then escalated into more serious safety issues. This relates to procedures, policies, training of employees, quality of workmanship. There's a large number of factors that are being examined that we will independently examine relative to that. I am fairly certain if you look at the history of rail transit in the world that an improperly torqued bolt resulting in a derailment has occurred and certainly has resulted in equipment failures and significant shutdowns, because it's important to keep in mind that if a bolt is improperly torqued, it leads us and others professionals to believe what else is going on. Are there other concerns relative to the training of people, relative to the quality of the procedures, policies, quality assurance, quality control that goes on that would allow that to occur? So that's one of the things that we're looking at. We know that RTG, RTM, and Alstom are also looking at it, as is your team in OC Transit. So a big deal. It's a big issue. And I don't know if I've been able to specifically address whether or not the improperly torqued bolt resulted in a shutdown of the system. But I can tell you there certainly have been safety stand downs at rail transit systems that I'm aware of as a result of determining that, in fact, bolts were not properly torqued, or they discovered that there was alignment issues with bolts.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Korak. My next question then, I guess leading on that, is for Mr. Truchon, if he's able to answer. Is he aware of any other people who use Alstom vehicles who have reported similar problems, or is it just Ottawa?
Hi, it's Mario. Mary Guerra, I'll take that question in lieu of Mr. Truchon. To the best of my knowledge, the answer is no. We're not aware of any other incidents of this nature involving Alstom vehicles.
Okay, thank you. The final assembly of the vehicles that are being used in Ottawa was in Ottawa, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And who was responsible for overseeing the final, you know, construction?
Well, ultimately, RTG and the city are both responsible for overseeing the assembly of the vehicles.
Manufacturing processes are typically very precise, very rigorous. So it would have been someone's job to actually torque the bolts properly and to verify that they had been torqued. Is that correct?
Yes, the quality control processes would have called for a verification that it was done.
Okay, but that was not done in this case.
In this particular case, no, it was not.
Okay, so that to me seems like a relatively easy fix, does it not?
I guess in the simplest of terms, you could say that, but you know, we're not certainly looking at that. We're looking at it in a much more holistic way, in terms of, and so is our subcontractor. You know that we are taking this as an opportunity to ensure that all of our quality control systems are in place, and we're augmenting the teams to ensure that nothing like this or anything else ever happens again. So,
okay, and that's great to hear. And as I say, it's a little bit troubling, though, given all the other issues that have happened with the Ottawa LRT, that this is the only apparently Alstom customer that has seen that issue arise.
I, Mr. Chair, to the best of my knowledge, I don't know of any other, but I think, as Ken alluded, I'm sure if we go, you know, deep enough, we could probably find other incidents. But to the best of my knowledge and my years of experience, I don't know of any other incidents involving an Alstom vehicle.
Okay, thank you. And my last question, I guess, for Mr. Korak, and I just want to make sure of one thing. You mentioned that you would monitor the effective execution of RTG's plan. I think it was you who said that. I don't think it was Mr. Charter. And it just it occurred to me there's execution, but there's effective execution, and the effective execution means that it actually has an effect lasting after the plan is actually put in place. How long are you looking to monitor the plan to show that it is in fact effective? If it requires staff or people working for RTG or even OC Transport, for example, to be retrained or be trained to a higher level, how long does the monitoring take place?
It's a good question, and I wish I could answer it, but there is no one set answer, whether it's 3 months or 6 months or a year. I think that in our analysis, what we want to see is first that in all of the mitigation strategies that are put in place in order to affect the restoration of service, that there is a close nexus between what the identified failures were in the RCA and what the proposed fixes are, and that they are closely aligned. Number two, that in fact everyone is cognizant of that and is working towards that plan in terms of the effective implementation of the mitigation strategies. With regard to, I think, the core of your question, which is how long does that level of then detailed due diligence or oversight occur for to make sure that people are doing what they're supposed to be doing? I think that's going to be as a result of, you know, do you see really great changes? Do you see the fact that if there is a very, very close nexus to procedure, policy, and implementation going forward? Or do you still see issues? And I've always been a strong believer in a very, very solid system of checks and balances. You have people that design the procedures, you have people that train the employees, you have the employees doing the work, you have the independent safety inspectors, both internal and external to the organization, that look at that. And that pyramid of safety keeps things very safe. And for some of this stuff, it just goes on in perpetuity, and it should, where you have a group of people that closely follows. Not suggesting that it's us, but that somebody needs then critique on a regular basis. There's something called internal audits, internal safety inspections that are done by independent parties just to make sure that people are doing what they're supposed to be doing and it's done in conformance with the identified procedures. So no one answer to how long that goes on for, but if you ask my professional opinion, that just becomes part of the furniture moving forward, that you always have a group of people independently examining those things so you can potentially minimize the risk of those things happening.
Mr. Chair, if I can just add to that, please.
Yes, of course.
That's a very good question. If I can sort of address it from an RTG and Alstom perspective as well. So, you know, our subcontractor is reviewing all of its quality control, quality assurance processes to ensure that things are improved in terms of how we're providing oversight on any work that gets done. And that includes, as Ken said, employee training, qualifications, retraining if required, and having the proper tools in place to be able to do the job and so on. RTG, and specifically RTM, is also reorganizing to ensure that we provide the proper oversight on our subcontractor to ensure that this doesn't happen again. And that will include bringing additional third-party resources in to help set up that process and to help launch and even perform that over a short period of time. So the answer as to how long, my response to you is the length of the time of this concession. That process will be in place for that period of time. And we will share that, and we've started to share some of that with the city and obviously TRA, and we will continue to share that to ensure that they're comfortable with what our plans are going forward from a quality control and quality assurance perspective. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mario.
Thank you, Mr. Korak. Thank you, Mr. Guerra, for the responses. Mr. Chair, those are all my questions.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Next up is Councillor Brockington, please, followed by Councillor Gower, followed by Councillor McKinney.
Thanks, Chair. Good afternoon to you and colleagues. First, Madame Emika, bienvenue. I look forward to meeting you, I think, later this week. So welcome to Ottawa, your new home. And I do want to thank the RTG, RTM, TRA executives for being here today. It's appreciated. We need this, and I appreciate your presence and answers to our questions. I'm going to start first with the R1 service, get some bus questions addressed first, and then I'll come back to the trains. Mr. Scrimger, what is our peak bus capacity on the R1 during 1 hour at rush hour? How many people can we shuttle on the R1 at rush hour right now.
If you can give me a minute to look that up, I do have that number close at hand, but it's going to take me a moment to find it. Is that okay?
Of course, yes. My second question will be, what is our LRT capacity on the Confederation line? I'd like to know what we normally shuttle, number of passengers during 1 hour of rush hour on the LRT trains. I want to know what we're offering right now to understand the delta between those two points.
I can answer the second and third questions more easily than the first.
Okay.
The capacity of the light rail line when 15 trains are in operation is between 10 and 11,000 people per hour. That's the capacity to move people.
Okay.
The ridership that we carried pre-pandemic, when we were at our highest ridership on the line shortly after it opened, was between 8 and 9,000 people per hour.
Okay.
The ridership on the line during the pandemic has varied between approximately 10% to 25% of pre-pandemic ridership. It fell very low. Our ridership, as you may remember, ridership fell lower on the train than it did on the complete system because of the train's primary ridership being office workers and university students. So if we go, if we take a range and say that if we were carrying 8,000 people an hour, and then during the pandemic, we're now carrying between 10 and 25% of that, we'd be carrying, 1 or 2,000 people per hour on the train at current ridership levels. These are all approximations. Now, I'm waiting for that number to appear in my text of what our current capacity is, but I believe, I'll correct it when I get the exact number, but I believe the capacity that we currently have on the R1 bus service is slightly below 2,000 people per hour. So it appears to be the right capacity to move the people who are actually traveling on R1. We know that some people have shifted their travel pattern or shifted their travel time or are traveling differently or traveling less than they would if the train had been in place. And I'll get you that number and I'll get it to you as soon as I have it.
Thank you, Mr. Scrimger. If this was not a pandemic, this city would be grinded to a halt. It would be, I don't know what else word to use. We saw it before pandemic when the trains were not functioning. We have to get this right, guys. This can never happen again, ever. From something like a bolt, as I think Commissioner Olson made his point quite clear, we cannot have this happen again, period. It can't happen again. So I guess I'm going to transition straight into trains now. I have other bus questions, but the train is a good segue, and that is for TRA, are you just focusing on the root causes of the two derailments? Or, similar to a question I asked recently, I think that was a council meeting, is we can focus on, and obviously we need to focus on the root causes of the two derailments, but we put the trains back in service, and then something we haven't looked at, there's no reason to look at this time, happens 3 weeks later, 6 weeks later, something we've not been paying attention to. No triggers, no reason for us to look at it, breaks down. So how thorough is the review? How thorough is the investigation in addition to determining the root causes of the derailments? Are we putting the train carriages through a dissection? What additional review, assessment, analysis is going to be provided?
I can start with an answer to that. And again, Ken and Chris certainly chime in if there's anything else you'd like to add. I think the answer is maybe comes in a couple of forms. Our areas of concentration are both on the root causes of these two derailments and then on the larger safety management system process. So the process that we rely on, and then from an oversight and regulatory perspective, OC Transpo and the line overall rely on to minimize the potential and the potential severity for accidents and incidents going forward. So we have a strong interest in both, for sure, both in these two particular issues and then in looking at the potential for other incidents. Just as you said, sir, we're very interested in what would be next, right? I mean, that's always the question, is once we get this buttoned up, unlikely that we're going to have this issue again. The question is, what else should we be interested in? So a robust safety management system, a robust SMS that covers the entire operation, everyone involved in all aspects of the operation, is very much an area of interest for us. And that's what's going to get the project and the rail system to a safe and to a sustainable place. So that's definitely very much on the agenda for us. The other part that I'd like to mention just quickly is you had noted sort of the idea of sort of a dissection of the train sets and going over those with a fine tooth comb, as we might think about it. Certainly that is part of the process, and that's part of the discussion that the contractor is putting together, RTG is putting together, to check critical connections and to ensure that all the most critical components of the train have been examined and been cleared for service. So that's definitely on the agenda as well. And dialing back to the audits, the oversight, the monitoring that I mentioned earlier, we would anticipate being very much plugged into ensuring that process happens and that it's documented and accounted for and verified appropriately.
So are you months away from releasing and making a recommendation? Are you, this sounds, to me at least, like a lengthy process. You spelled out in your presentation all the the steps that you wanted to take, the methodology behind that.
Yeah.
Are we thinking in the month of November we will see passengers on trains, or are you going to take more time to do what you need to do?
So I think two things that come to mind for me on that. One is there are some of these processes that we are looking to see that the project, the line overall, OC Transpo, the contractors, as appropriate, commit to and plan for appropriate actions going forward. So the SMS process is a good example where any transit agency that even has a robust SMS process would tell you that's a growth process. That's an ongoing process, and it's not the type of thing where you flip a light switch and it's instantaneously in place. But to have those plans aligned and those processes aligned and the commitments going forward to work together on those things is really the foundation of that. So that's what we look to see in those areas shorter term, and then over the longer term, very similar to coming into to audit the checks of torque and checks of critical connections. Over the longer term, we would look to see that those items are being audited and monitored for implementation. So the shorter term, getting the vehicles back to service, getting the line back to service, I think, you know, the timelines that were mentioned earlier are possible. Certainly we'll see in the final form of the return to service plan if that's the reality, but it's possible. But the other activities that we mentioned, some of that monitoring and safety implementation, we recognize is an ongoing process.
Thank you. And the city manager has honored my request for a technical briefing in advance of restarting passenger service. You will be leading that briefing, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Scrimger, I saw your hand up. Do you have that number?
I do have that number. Thank you for your patience. The service that's currently running on the R1 has the capacity to move approximately 2,100 people per hour per direction.
Thank you for looking that up. I do appreciate it. Chair, I'll yield the floor now. Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, thank you very much, Councillor. And so next up will be Councillor Gower, please.
Thanks, Chair. I have two areas that I want to focus on. The first is the idea of extending transfer time. This has come up before, but it came up today from one of the delegations. I guess for Mr. Scrimger, I think currently in the daytime, it's a 90-minute transfer time. Is that correct?
That's correct. Our system is programmed to accept the same fare for... So what that starts from is 90 minutes from when the person pays the fare on the bus or taps in their smart card at an O-train station if they were open, or some people are still starting their trips at stations. So from the moment they pay their fare, 90 minutes until they, within that 90-minute period, they can transfer onto the last bus of their trip. So their trip might extend more than 90 minutes, but it's 90 minutes from the time they pay their fare to the time they transfer onto the last bus of their trip. If it's longer than that, and if there's been a delay in service, we're always happy, and we do routinely provide refunds to people if, you know, if a trip's been missed and they've missed a connection because of a service failure on our part. Just for context, we extend that also to 105 minutes early in the morning, after 6 p.m., and the hours are slightly different on Saturdays and Sundays to allow for the fact that many services are less frequent at those times, early and late and on weekends.
Okay. I don't think that part about issuing refunds is widely known. Do you get a lot of requests for refunds based on service-related issues on the 90-minute expiration?
We get some. It's not a giant number, but it's a routine question that comes up and we deal with regularly.
Are there technical limitations? If we were to ask you today to go and extend it by 30 minutes, let's say, how would that happen? What do you have to do?
So first of all, we have to check with our fare system suppliers to be confident of our belief that no software change is required, because a software change would take a full change process. But we think we can do it by just changing the database that's held in all of the units. What that normally means to replace that database, and this is a database that we change when there's a fare change, like at the beginning of a new year. We change the database, we test the database, we run it through all tests to make sure that the configuration of the database is working well, and then we upload that database both to the fare system that runs the fare gates and also to the smart card reader on all of the buses. Usually that process takes about a month to be sure that we've from start to finish, coding the database, testing the database, putting it on some buses to make sure that it's working and not causing any other problems, and then pushing it out over the air or when required using a direct connection to the computers on the bus to every bus and the system. We obviously do it as quickly as possible, but just to give an idea, that's how long it usually takes to do a database upgrade for a fare change.
About a month. By which point we may or may not have a resumption in train service. We could still have R1 buses running. Likely we will still have R1. I guess I think it's worth looking at, appreciating it does take some time and it's not something that could be implemented tomorrow. I think it's worth looking at least until we know that R1 service isn't being relied on a regular basis. I'd like to introduce a motion. I don't know what the wording is exactly, but I think it's something around as soon as possible, extending the transfer limit by 30 minutes until such time that the R1 bus replacement is no longer needed. I'll work on the wording with staff on this to get it right, but I think it's worth looking at, and it's a small gesture. I'm not sure how helpful it would be, but I think it's something we've heard again and again from riders that it would be a helpful thing right now, while we don't know how long this R1 bus replacement is going to be in place. So I'll work on the wording and I'll come back to that later. The other area I want to focus on was, I mentioned it earlier, the confidentiality of the return to service plan. So Mr. Kanellakos, I just want to make sure everyone understands, the city is willing to release this publicly, but under our project agreement, that is a confidential document until such time that Rideau Transit Group agrees to release it. Is that correct?
Well, it's a bit more nuanced than that, Mr. Chair. As I said in my memo yesterday, I consulted with the city clerk, who's our head of the organization with respect to release of information and under the act. And I also consulted with our lawyer, Sharon Vogel, because of the briefing that you've received in camera on our ongoing legal cases. And with respect to the clerk, the information, and he's dug up the case law, is that this information is protected, not only because we have a relationship with RTG, we have to ask their permission to release it. So we can't release it without their permission, and even then when we want to release it, they could appeal it to the Privacy Commissioner of Ontario. And our lawyer has advised us that even though, you know, she doesn't want us to break solicitor-client privilege and has basically cautioned me to say that, you know, we're not waiving any privilege in this matter by the advice she's given us that I've publicly shared, because we are going to act in good faith in everything we do. But RTG obviously could make a case that we're breaching the agreement and could jeopardize our future legal action that council has directed us to take in our in-camera briefing the other week. And so it is up to RTG, and I think RTG would probably have to check with Alstom. I've seen the report, and I just want to tell you that it's 140 pages of pictures, of diagrams and photos of very specific components and subcomponents down to bolts with specific technical guidelines and standards in terms of maintaining those parts as part of their vehicle, overall vehicle fleet assessment. So it's a very, very technical document. And I understand why RTG might be hesitant, or also might be hesitant, because the plan actually documents their proprietary information. And so the act, as Mr. O'Connor always advised me, has two parts. It's about protection of privacy and freedom of information. And commercial entities and individuals have the right to protect certain information. There's case law on that. There's a privacy commissioner that guides that. And so we are not going to break the law and do anything inappropriate. So we've asked them formally to whether they would release it. But that's an assessment they have to make with their organization in terms of what damage that may cause them. And obviously through their lawyers. And we have not heard back from them at this point.
With Mr. Trushon here, Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Trushon, what is your willingness to release this document in whole or in part?
Mr. Chair, we've provided the plan 5 days ago to the city. The plan is currently being reviewed with the city and TRA, and we expect that there will be revisions that will come from that review. As Mr. Kanellakos mentioned, the plan is a very detailed technical document. And it doesn't hide anything. It's just technical proprietary information about the vehicle. And we have commercial arrangement with our subcontractor that protects confidentiality. And we need to respect those arrangements as well. So right now we're working with them to see what could be released. And we're not obstructing. We just want to make sure that we remain fair and protect the confidential information of our subcontractor.
Thank you. Mr. Trushon, do you understand the link that the public and many councillors, me included, are making between transparency and confidence in the system?
Yes, we do.
I want to hear some commitment from our TM. I understand there's commercially sensitive material that may be in there. I think the public really wants to see, as much as we give them the summary today, and I think the summary from staff and from TRA was excellent. As much as we provide a summary, there's many people in the public who won't be satisfied until they see that return to service plan from RTM. And if we put aside the commercially sensitive information that I think may be reasonable, the public may understand why that particular information can't be shared. I don't think the public is going to be satisfied until they do see that return to service plan as full as possible. Do you understand that? And can we hear clearly a commitment from RTM today to release as much of that information as possible?
As I indicated previously, our concern is not with commercially sensitive information. Our concern is about proprietary information about vehicle design. That's completely unrelated to the possible dispute we may have with the city. So as far as we're concerned, it's about getting the plan approved and signed off with the city and TRA. And once we have something that's approved, we will work to try to extract whatever relevant information would be available to the commission as far as the actual return to service, while at the same time protecting the confidentiality of the information that's not ours.
Okay, thank you. I think it's important that councillors, commissioners, and the public understand where you stand on that. And it is something that's very important to me, and I think to all of us, that we be as transparent to the public as possible on the information that we have. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Councillor Gower. Next up is Councillor McKenney, please.
Thank you.
Councillor Deans.
Thank you, Chair. I have to say I'm not impressed by anything I've heard yet today. I'm actually left with far more questions than I came in with, to be honest. And I think really one of the most gobsmacking comments from staff that I heard today was that Alstom would uplift competencies of leadership in Ottawa and bring in fresh and qualified resources. Now, after 2 years of constant dysfunction on this system, now, after we've shut down this system numerous times and had to run R1 service after paying you $2.1 billion for a system that does not function, now, after two derailments, a second one that could have been absolutely catastrophic, you're going to bring in fresh and qualified resources. I don't know about the people watching this today. I don't know about our public today, but I have a hard time believing you, I'll be honest. Why now? Our outgoing general manager, I have a question for your outgoing general manager. This is to RTG, RTM. Told us on his way out that we have one major question to ask and to get on the table. Alstom, Alstom, Alstom. I'm asking you now, is Alstom to blame for what's happening on our system? Or is it that you didn't know how to build a system and you put a $2.1 billion system in place that you either underbid on or had no expertise to undertake the maintenance for your system? Which is it?
Thank you for the question. I think ultimately there's enough blame to go around when an incident like this happens. We acknowledge that it's something that's unacceptable and that has had a huge impact on the citizens of Ottawa.
But it's not just this. Sorry. I just want to back you up a little bit. I'm not talking just about this incident. I'm talking about 2 years of complete dysfunction of a rail system that Ottawa, this city, paid $2.1 billion for. So just want to back that up a wee bit.
Mr. Chair, I think we've had our challenges. We've had our problems. Unfortunately, we had two back-to-back high-profile incidents that have happened, which kind of puts us where we are today. It's not uncommon in any startup system with a new vehicle that we have issues with that require retrofits, and this particular system hasn't been any different than others. The unfortunate thing is that we had these two back-to-back incidents so close to each other. And one of them is related to workmanship and not, you know, any sort of technical or design issue. So for that, I think everybody's to blame. RTG, RTM, Alstom, and that is why we are working very diligently with our subcontractor, with the city, with TRA, to ensure that it never happens again.
Can you name another system that for the first 2 years, not after 30 years, but for the first 2 years of operation has had the issues that we have had? Could you just name me one or two?
Well, I don't think I can name you a system that has had these specific issues, but I can tell you Toronto Transit Commission's new streetcars, they seized shipment of those vehicles until they got it right. The major difference there, and I worked at Toronto Transit Commission, so I know the operation well. The only what's different there than it is in Ottawa is that it had legacy vehicles that they could maintain a certain level of service even without their new vehicles. Unfortunately, the city of Ottawa does not have that, being a brand new system. So when anything happens and the fleet is grounded, as has happened twice now recently, we just don't have that luxury of putting other legacy vehicles out for service. You know, I've seen it in other places like New York City, where cars, they stop the shipment of cars and send them back until they get their issues. So it's not unheard of. Like I said, in my 40 years of experience, the biggest difference is that we've had two high-profile incidents back-to-back. That I can tell you with all a great degree of honesty, I have never experienced before.
Okay, well, that's not an answer to my question, but if you can, at any point, send us some evidence of another system that has had, not just with the trains, but with the tracks, with the catenary, with the gearboxes, on and on and on, in the first 2 years of revenue service availability, if you could point us to that in that direction, I'd be happy to see that. So do you have the expertise on the ground here in Ottawa to maintain this system? I mean, we're turning now back to you to fully inspect this entire fleet when you built it. You built it improperly, and now it doesn't seem like you can maintain it. It's your own design and build. So do you have the expertise on the ground? Do you have the right people on the ground today to maintain the system?
Yes, I believe we do, Mr. Chair. Most of the issues that have happened on the system are due to our technical issues that happen on most systems. I don't know that we can point to very many issues that had to do with the actual maintenance of the system. But nevertheless, this particular last issue did. And that is why we are looking to ensure that it never happens again. And we're working with the city and TRI to make sure that that's the case.
And why wasn't the expertise brought in before this? Why did we have to wait until we had two derailments in the city on our system?
I think the expertise was here, but as I think we're finding out now, the processes probably, were not as robust as they should be. And that's kind of where we're focusing our attention now.
I just want to go back to the plan. And I want to understand why these aspects of the plan, and this could be to our own staff, were not in place before now, why they weren't in place after the first derailment or even in the first 2 years when we had multiple shutdowns. So the core elements of Safe Return to Service Plan, looking at undertaking an intensive fleet inspection program of all critical safety components and hardware, and implement a quality assurance, quality governance process for the overall return to service plan. I'm unsure why that wasn't done previous to today.
Well, if I can, Mr. Chair, fleet inspections have been in place and have been done many times throughout this project. As it's happened, we conduct fleet inspections to check the remainder of the fleet so that we're confident in the safety of the system going forward. As far as QAQC plans, they were in place and have been in place, but as I think I indicated earlier, obviously not robust enough, and that's why we're revisiting them and ensuring that they are robust enough going forward. And once again, we're doing that under the guidance and assistance of TRA and the city, and that's our commitment to the city of Ottawa, is to ensure that this does not happen again.
So two components of your
Councillor McKenney, the clerk had given you the 1 minute warning and told you your time was up. So are you okay if I put you back on the list and we go to Councillor Dean?
Yeah, I'll go back on the list, Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Councillor Deans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I want to start out by trying to understand the dynamic in this partnership. So we have heard from RTG that they believe they can return to operations or service on November 1st. The city thinks the first 2 weeks. The TSB is in here. They're still in the investigative phase. I just want to understand who has the ultimate green light to say this can go back into service. Is that the city?
Yeah, I'd like to take this question, Mr. Chair. There's a number of roles, and we've got, I actually documented the regulatory roles and responsibilities, which I think it's a fair question because it can seem complicated and a little foggy in terms of how this happens because of the unique nature of the City of Ottawa being a federally regulated transit system, and that complicates things significantly. But effectively, what happened is because we are federally regulated, Transport Canada has in fact designated us as a rail transit regulatory authority, which means that the city manager is the basically the chief executive under the act. To investigate LRT incidents and accidents and to make the final decision, a green light on whether we go back into service or not. And the City Council delegated this rail transit authority to the city manager through the regulatory bylaw. So this was a requirement of Transport Canada, and it's not unusual. It's basically what happens in almost every other light rail system in the country. And then you have the issue of Transit Commission and Council, which has the general oversight over LRT matters, receives reports and updates, but there's no requirement under the regulations for Transit Commission to give authority to return it based on the Act, the Transportation Act. And then you get into the Transportation Safety Board, which has no authority to regulate our operations or to tell us whether we can go back in service or not. So they basically investigate and issue recommendations to us as the owner of the system. So they're an independent body that issues recommendations but can't necessarily tell us when we can go back in service. Transport Canada, based on the delegation of agreement, will not and won't participate in the return to safety plan or recommencement, but they monitor. Then we've got Sam Barada, who acts as council's basically technical advisor, and it has a separate mandate under his work to ensure that the ongoing safety of the system is maintained. But there's no regulatory requirement for him to give approval. TRA, there's no regulatory requirement for them either to give approval. They give recommendations as directed by council, Transit Commission and Council. We've hired them as an independent body, and they effectively advise us, ultimately me, in terms of whether this goes back in service or not. And then OC Transpo is the same thing. There's no specific requirement for them to formally approve it. We've actually separated the regulatory framework from OC Transport to keep an independence so that they're kept out of the decision. That's why TRA does not report to OC Transport and has been hired as an independent body for me. And then, of course, RTG Group, they don't have a regulatory obligation to do it, but they're required to report to us and provide all the remedial actions based on the project agreement. So in a nutshell, once all the safety people, RTG, Alstom, everyone submits all their stuff and TRA does the final review as they describe in their scope of work, the recommendation comes to the city manager for final approval. But based on the recommendation or the direction from Councillor Brockington, I have agreed and I think it's very prudent that we will do a technical briefing, which will run through the return to service plan and all the steps that were taken and reviewed by TRA, which will lead it to give people assurance that any decision I'm making is completely out in the open. So you'll receive the same information that I'm receiving before that decision is made. We'll have the same information completely.
Okay, thank you for that answer. Appreciate that because it's very confusing. There's a lot of actors in this space. Do you I know the TSB is independent and they've been here, but have they offered any advice to you, Mr. Kanellakis, in terms of the appropriateness of a return to service? Or do you expect to hear from TSB when you meet with them about whether or not they think the system is ready to return to service?
Well, we just received the plan on 5 days ago. On Friday, we took the whole weekend. TRA was engaged fully all weekend reviewing the plan. They're still going through the plan, and I have not received an update from them other than through Michael Morgan and through Troy and the.
I was asking about the Transportation Safety Board, who are doing an independent investigation.
No, the Transportation Safety Board has not issued us any other information other than what's been posted on their website publicly. They're still doing their investigation. They've not shared with us any other information at this point, and I have not communicated with them other than my request to release their documentation, which they replied to us, and I released that yesterday, their letter yesterday, where under the act that they operate, they won't release the investigation, just like Ottawa Police wouldn't release an investigation, an ongoing investigation, or RCMP or anybody else. No investigative body will do that in the course of a investigation. So that's fair. I expected that from them, but we did ask. But that's the last correspondence I've had from them.
So as part of your due diligence, would you be asking the Transportation Safety Board their opinion about the timing of return to service?
Well, that's not their role to give us their opinion on the role of service. Their role is to give us recommendations on the safety aspects in terms of what we should be implementing in terms of advisories or orders. And so, my intention would be that we'd be speaking to them, but I wouldn't be relying on them in terms of return to service. I'm relying on TRA in terms of their review of all the information for return to service.
Okay. So we heard, this is not the first time I've heard this. It sounds very familiar. But we heard the city say that they don't think November 1st is a realistic date. It's very unlikely that it's a realistic date for return to service, but RTG has given us notice that they expect to have partial return to service on November 1st and will be providing us a full return to service plan by the end of the week. And I guess my question to RTG, the representative, Mr. Turgeon from RTG, is We saw this initially. I sat in a committee meeting one day and watched this unfold, where the representative from RTG told us that they were going to be ready to provide the initial service to the city. Mr. Manconi was sitting beside him. And when I asked Mr. Manconi said, oh, there's no way they're going to meet that deadline. So I feel like, history is repeating itself here. And I guess I'm wondering why you continue to provide unrealistic deadlines, which is very confusing to all of us, including the public, in terms of a plan for return to service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Mary Aguirre. I'll take that. So what we've communicated to the city is that we expect that the inspection regime, which is pending TRA and city approval, will allow us to have completed 7 trains plus a spare by November 1st. Now, obviously, on top of that, there are processes and procedures that will need to be followed, such as some of the ones that have been discussed here, where the system needs to be tested for 1, 2, 3 days, whatever is deemed necessary. Our commitment is that we will have sufficient vehicles ready for testing purposes by November 1st. That's our commitment.
And Mr. Kanellakis, does this lead us right down the legal path where RTG says they're ready to return to service and the city says they're not, and ultimately this goes to court and they say we should get our milestone payment because we were ready to go, the city held us up? I mean, does this just become another legal challenge?
Obviously there could be legal challenges coming out of this, as you know, but as councillors know from the briefing, but our focus right now is on getting the trains back. And that's not where we're certainly I'm headed in terms of, they've given a date, which they, as Mr. Guerrero explained, but they can't, as I kind of explained earlier in terms of the regulatory authority, they can't go back into service until we tell them. If there's an issue around the payments and all the rest of it, that's something we have to discuss. Right now, I wouldn't hold up the, if the question was posed to me, should we be holding up the return to service after TRA said it's fine because we're having a dispute over the money? My preference would be to give them some kind of prorated money to get the service back up and running and then deal with that later. I don't want to get caught up in a legal commercial dispute and keep the train sitting on the sideline. The objective here is once TRA presents their findings publicly and we think we're good to go and it's safe, we want to put the trains back in service. And if there's a financial discussion about that, we'll deal with that. But at the end of the day, we make the decision when the trains go back into service, not RTG.
Mr. Chair, if I may just add to what Mr. Kanellakis said, our goal is that while those vehicles are being inspected, that we work with TRA in parallel to ensure and in the hopes that by the time we reach November 1st, you know, we would have satisfied all the needs that the city, everything that the city needs and TRA to get comfortable with the safety of the system. So we're going to work tirelessly with the city and TRA to ensure that by the time we hit November 1st, you know, all those boxes will be checked and we can hit the ground running. That's the goal. The goal is not to sit back and not do anything until November 1st.
Thank you. Mr. Gard, do the city staff and our consultants, TRA, Mr. Barada, everyone have unimpeded, unfettered, unescorted access to the maintenance facility?
Absolutely. Transparency has been a big, big factor here. I'll give you an example. You know, during the work on the infrastructure, we had daily updates, and both TRA, the city, our subcontractors, our people attended those meetings daily. Full transparency on everything. Any report, any information that's been provided by our subcontractor on the vehicle, we flowed through as expeditiously as we can. And many times we are reviewing that information concurrently with the city and TRA in order to expedite the process so that we can get back to safe, reliable service as soon as possible. So full transparency throughout the entire.
Thank you for that answer. I wanted to talk about one of the results from the TSB investigation into the August 8th derailment. I think citizen member Anthony Caricato had asked this, but I just want to follow up because one of the findings was that regular maintenance or visual inspections were insufficient to adequately mitigate against bearing failures. And they had suggested as part of the return to service plan the installation of heat detection systems. Now, I think I heard Daniel Hauber say that thermal bearing detection systems are not the norm. So I'm just wondering if I heard that correctly, and if you're not recommending that system be placed on these trains. And we've heard from the TSB that the visual inspection is inadequate. What is the fix for that issue?
So I'll address the visual inspection question first, Mr. Chair, if I can. The unit that failed, the bearing unit, is a sealed unit, and thus we don't have the ability to do any visual checks on it on an ongoing basis. So that is the reason why visual wouldn't have helped. Now, obviously, we do have a short-term mitigation every 7,500 kilometers. That may turn into something that we do more often once the root cause investigation is completed. But at this point, it's not possible for us to visually see that bearing. Just the check that we're currently conducting for play. And with regards to the heat detection, I don't think anybody's discounting anything. It is true with what TRA said. I have a lot of business, a lot of experience, and I've never seen, you know, heat detectors used in LRTs. But you know, there's other technology. There may be other technologies out there that would work. You know, the temperature thresholds here are just not high enough for heat detection to work, is what I'm being told, and I'm not an expert on it. But I can tell you that both us and our subcontractor are taking a serious look at it, and if it's heat detectors or something else that we can put in place to help mitigate and hopefully prevent these incidents in the future.
So if we don't have a solution yet to the August 8th problem that created the derailment, how are we talking about a return to service or partial service on November 1st?
No, what we have, Mr. Chair, is a mitigation where we check vehicles every 7,500 kilometers to ensure that there isn't play on those bearings beyond the point that is acceptable. And that's the mitigation. And we have found a couple of cars. One was a false positive where we're doing that. So that's the short-term mitigation. The long-term mitigation, unfortunately, we do not expect to have that until sometime in December when the root cause investigations come.
Can I just interject, because I want to make sure Councillor Dean's question gets answered, because I think what she's saying is, and forgive me, Councillor Dean, if I'm interpreting your question, but I just want, and I think this is to TRA, but I think what she's saying is, can the trains go back in service even though the TSB recommendation has not been implemented? And how can we be sure that those trains can be safe if there isn't that solution? And Daniel, could you, my understanding is it's the frequency of inspection, the type of inspection can mitigate those things, but I'd like to hear from the experts. I'm not an expert in this. Daniel?
Sure, yeah, thank you. So I think maybe going back, Commissioner, to address part of your question that rang with me. In my experience, thinking of other light rail systems that we've worked with, there have been quite a few. I don't know of any that use thermal bearing detection. I would not, though, necessarily say that means that it might not be useful, or that some type of a detection system might not be useful. So I think that it might be worthwhile to think about those two things separately. And certainly in the world of rail transit, there are a lot of unique features, a lot of unique systems. Some of them are one-offs in individual rail systems because they're helpful to that rail system. So I think it's important to think about that as maybe two separate questions. And then with regard to, as City Manager, as Mr. Kanellakos mentioned, the idea of going back into service with the current state of the investigation and where we are now. I think that this is really at the core of TRA's work at this point, is trying to get to a good level of confidence in the root cause analyses from the contractor, from the vehicle supplier, to understand well what the suspected root causes are, and based on the information at hand, whether or not appropriate mitigations have been put to those. So in thinking about that process, if there's a conclusion in the root cause analysis that there's been a particular mode of failure for these bearings, then the idea would be to put in place appropriate mitigations and appropriate checks to catch those bearings before they're catastrophically failed. And that's really at the core of what we're doing right now, is assessing that root cause analysis and also assessing the mitigations that have been recommended by the contractor to catch those issues.
And thank you.
I might
that.
Just jump in. Oh, you don't mind, I'll jump in. Okay. Yeah, Dan's point. This would be a normal practice when you discover a flaw in a piece of equipment or a subsystem on a rail car. We've seen this with trucks on bogies of rail cars at different properties here that either we've dealt with or we've just seen in the industry, where there might be cracking in that. So until you can resolve the problem or get to that root cause of, was it the casting of it, was it some other issue, you find out what that cycle is for the inspection. And so and that it needs to be to prevent the cracking in that particular case from propagating. And so in this instance, that's what we're looking for, is that assurance that the inspection cycle is appropriate to catch any potential issue, and it's at the appropriate frequency, that nothing would come up between each inspection.
Yeah, I don't know enough about this to really be able to speak about it, but it just seems to me that if the TSB said an inspection isn't enough, and we're saying, okay, well, let's do inspections more frequently, it seems like that's not the solution. And I would hope that you would look at what was suggested, these heat detection systems in this case, in this climate. And, you know, here's the thing that I want you as TRA to understand. We've had two derailments. We've had 2 years of failings in this system right off the bat. We have very low trust and confidence in the system at this point. And we have to assure our citizens that this system is safe. And I think we have to go the extra mile to make sure that we're doing that. And so just shortening their maintenance inspections doesn't sound like enough of a solution to me. So I would be looking to you to not give us any, to say half-assed, I guess I'll just say solutions at this point. Like, we want real lasting solutions that we are confident in, and our confidence is just low. So I'll leave it at that, but we are looking for you to go that extra mile to make sure that when we invite our transit customers to go back on those trains, that we can be assured they're safe. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could, because it's really an important issue that was raised, and I sort of want to go maybe from micro to macro, just for a moment, relative to our scope and what we've been assigned to do. What we've been.
Can you speak a little louder?
Can you hear me? Okay.
Just barely.
Can you hear me? Yes.
Yes, can.
Okay. Thank you. So, as Dan and Chris both pointed out, there are short-term and long-term answers, solutions, corrective action plans to much of what you're concerned about and much of what's gone on and contributory factors to the two incidents on August 8th and September 19th. Our focus at this point is relative to the restoration of service plan. And to be very clear, if the concept was in terms of every type of engineering, every aspect of engineering must be addressed, resolved, codified, and put into place, it could be much longer before you have restoration. What we're been tasked to do and what we do on a regular basis is we are looking at what are the mitigation strategies that will safely and effectively allow you to restore service. That doesn't mean that there aren't longer term things to get fixed. Much of the engineering analysis that probably is going on and will go on may result in either long-term strategies or re-engineering or different things that we can't foresee at this point. But in terms of what is technically wrong, what does the root cause analysis show is wrong, and then what can be done short-term? If the answer is there's nothing short-term that can be done safely, then the answer is don't go back in service. But our goal here is to look at what are those, and the term is mitigation strategies that can be implemented in the short-term basis that gives us a high level of confidence that, in fact, the system is safe to be restored to service. And in many cases, that relates to the things that you've already heard about. Increased inspections, better inspections, more effective inspections, having a higher level of quality control and quality assurance, looking at components on a more regular basis, having more people, boots on the ground, out there assessing what's going on the basis. Those are short-term mitigation strategies that we will be looking at to see whether we can be safe and put the line back in service. And then there are a much probably longer and lot larger list of items that are longer-term in nature that will have to be addressed between the parties here.
Thank you.
Thank you for your answer. So, Councillor Deans, your time's up according to the coordinator. So, if you wish to go back on the list. Next up is Councillor Leeper, followed by Councillor Tierney. And then we will start the second round of questions. But what I'd like to propose to the Commission is we'll take a 20-minute break after Councillor Tierney and before we start the second round. So, go ahead when ready there, Councillor Leeper.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Chair. A few different questions. I think I want to come back to the bolt. I don't mean to go down an HR path with this line of questionings, but there was an improperly tightened bolt. Are we at the state of understanding what happened that we know there is a particular individual who didn't do their job, what that person's responsibilities are, whether or not they had the appropriate training to do the job that they were being asked to do? Do we have that level of understanding of what went wrong yet?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to take that question. Yes and no. So we understand when it happened, and it was actually during a shift change where the assumption was that something was done, it wasn't done. So we know that. We know what shift it happened. We know when it happened. We're a part of the ongoing process and review that's going on is to determine training, tools, and everything, quality control measures and everything that's in place to ensure that it doesn't happen again. So we know some things, but I wouldn't say we're in a position today to know everything. The investigation continues around that, and with it, the proposals to mitigate that in the future.
It's important to me that we develop that understanding, because to Commissioner Olson's point, you know, if this system, I mean, it is FUBAR, but this shutdown is the result of somebody who didn't do their job. It does seem like a relatively easy thing to do to make sure that people are doing their jobs.
Yeah, it is partly about that. It's about process. It's about having the right tools that ensure that these things are documented properly and whatnot. It's a wholesome picture that we have to take into account.
Okay, so I am glad to hear that we understand, you know, it sounds like in relatively granular detail what happened and when.
Yes.
That's critical.
Yes, we do.
The CBTC, I've forgotten what that stands for, the communications system, stopped the train in the second derailment issue at a certain point. What was the message? What was the algorithm? Why did the train stop? What did it detect that it needed to stop the train?
So CBTC is computer-based train control.
Thank you.
And what happened is when the vehicle derailed in the process of that, it took out a switch machine. And then the system senses that it's lost communication with the switch machine, and automatically the vehicle goes into what's called an emergency brake, and that's what brought the vehicle to a stop.
Okay, so there wasn't indication that there was something wrong with the vehicle. The stop happened because it stopped communicating.
Yes, when they lost the CBT, the control system lost communications with that particular switch, and that's what put the vehicle into emergency.
So had that switch been in a different place, 100 yards further on, 200 yards further on, the train would have continued in that derailed state?
It's difficult to speculate. Definitely a possibility. But at some point, you know, there are, and that's part of the investigation. That's at the heart of the investigation as well, is did the vehicle perform as it should have performed under that scenario? And that's something that's still ongoing. You know, we're looking at downloads and whatnot. You know, there are systems built into the vehicle, that safety critical systems, that, for example, if the wheels are not spinning at the same speed, then the vehicle detects that and puts it to a stop. In this particular incident, it's very possible, because it was a power bogey and the wheels were still technically turning, it may have gone further. But I'm only speculating at this point, Mr. Chair. I couldn't say with a great deal of certainty.
No, and I appreciate that that is just speculation, but I guess I'm disturbed that I don't want to assign sentiency to a vehicle, but I am disturbed that it didn't know it was off the rails.
Oh, I think everything's, I mean, I know the city's looking at operator training and what could be done from their perspective as well. We're certainly looking at the performance of the vehicle, obviously with our subcontractor, in terms of could something have happened sooner to give some sort of indication to the operator that something was wrong. So we are looking at that now, because it is cause for concern why it went on that long.
Yeah, I mean, are the right systems on the train to ensure that it's safe is a fundamental question, it seems to me.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, so, and that continues to be something that you're looking at. When would we have those answers? There's a lot of different processes and timeframes that we're talking about this morning. When would we know what the conclusions are with respect to whether or not the trains are equipped with the appropriate systems to know when there's a problem?
Yeah, I think as the TRA has illustrated, I think we're looking at this as short-term and long-term. I think short-term is to put the service back in a safe and reliable manner through some sort of mitigation measures, and then work on the more long-term solutions, whether that involves re-engineering or some sort of retrofit. So I look at it as short-term and long-term. You know, we can certainly, for example, quality control is obviously top of mind for everybody. We can certainly look at putting some short-term measures in place to ensure better QC and QA, but we need, and the city has asked for, a long-term plan in terms of how we can sustain that plan going forward. So I see it as short-term and long-term initiatives at this point.
Okay, so that'll actually segue me into my another question I have, which is around the briefing that councillors and the media and the public will be privy to with respect to the return plan. I don't know, Steve, if you're intending to provide that briefing once you've already approved the plan, or will we have that briefing before you approve the plan?
Mr. Chair, to Councillor Leeper, no, the plan won't be approved until we do the briefing.
Okay, so we'll have a chance to ask these questions probably all over again and satisfy ourselves that we have the answers we need and provide the input to you, and you'll make your decision.
That's correct.
Okay. I only have one other question. I think I'd heard that the railside thermal detection is not standard, or it's not a normal thing in a system like this. If we did determine that we wanted to put something like that in place, just curious, do we have the spectrum? Because I know those operate according to, I think the Railway Association of Canada controls the spectrum that controls that communication. I don't know if that's an issue that we would face if we did want to go with railside monitors.
Not sure if that was for RTG or not.
I don't know who knows the answer to that.
Michael, I'm in the room here with Michael Morgan, Chair, and he's saying that we would just hardwire it. We wouldn't have to deal with the spectrum.
Okay, fantastic. Those are my questions. Thank you very much, Chair. Thanks all.
Thank you, Councillor.
I'm sorry. Welcome, Renee.
Well, thank you, Councillor Leeper. So next up is Councillor Tierney, please, and then we'll take our break.
Great. Thank you, Chair. I'll keep it brief. First of all, bonjour, Madame Amilcar. Welcome. I'm very excited to work with you. I guess we're going to be meeting very soon. So, I'll start off with I have a bus question. And I guess between COVID and other things, which we've talked about during this this call, it's kind of saved our bacon here a little bit. 200 series buses. We dispensed of all the 200 series buses because they were riding around empty. The original plan was to have the 200 series buses back as the government started coming back and we saw people actually taking those buses. The numbers haven't really come up yet, which I guess is a blessing because we needed obviously the operators that would be operating those buses, or you know, the resources for those buses to supply the R1 service. I'm just asking because I am getting questions. Do we see a return to the 200 bus series in the future? Are we still watching the numbers coming in? And do you care to comment on the fact that we don't have the 200s running and how that, what would it look like if we actually had the 200s running? I think it would be pandemonium.
So I can answer some of these questions, Mr. Chair. So the first is that we made some service reductions in June, which we discussed here at Transformation earlier in the year. It was March, April, May. We made some service reductions in June, which reduced service on the connection routes, the 200 series routes, to every half hour, and also temporarily suspended a few of those routes which where there's other service within pretty much the same walking distance. Those and the other reductions, they weren't just on the 200 series routes. They were on a number of other routes too. We shortened some routes. We temporarily suspended some routes, and we talked about that at length at that time. That reduced the number of buses we needed to put on the road, and it reduced the number of operators that we needed to run service. And that was intended to reduce operating costs by $11 million a year, half of that in the current year. That saving would have been achieved with the current workforce because that number of workers need to go over to be trained and certified to run trains as the various stage two expansions come forward. So we were expecting those people to move into training and to move off the operating budget onto the capital budget. What we have done in order to get through this period is we've held those people back. They're still operating buses. They haven't moved to rail training yet. And in addition, we reduced service on a number of routes by canceling the trips that I listed earlier. And that's the number of buses that we had to free up and the number of operators that we've had to free up to provide enough R1 service to carry all the people who are currently traveling. Those numbers of, you know, about 2,000 people an hour that I was talking with Councillor Brockington about earlier. If those routes had not been reduced in June, we would have had to, in September, make those simple, you know, service reductions of similar volume, maybe the same way, maybe differently, but we would have had to make the same amount of reductions to free up the same number of buses to have enough people to move R1. And as Councillor Brockington, I believe it was, noted earlier, this has only been possible it's only been possible with such a defined, it's certainly been a large impact on customers, but it hasn't been a larger impact on customers than it would have been if we hadn't been at our current ridership level.
And I'm only asking that, Pat, because in the cancellation list, and this is what draws a little concern from me, is where I'll give you a good example. The 224 and the 24, very similar patterns and routes, would be driving around the neighborhood. I'm seeing heavy cancellations on the 24, the only alternative route that my constituents have to a high number. Are there decisions being made where the 200 routes, and if it's not, I think they have to look at it, where the 200 routes no longer exist? Are we looking at, okay, maybe we shouldn't be canceling the other route, the only other existing route they have? Because that's not what I'm seeing right now. And I'm getting a lot of very strong feedback from people that said, well, if the 224 was here, it would be fine. It'd wait another 15 minutes, but literally a bus hasn't shown up in half an hour. And we have to reduce those situations where people don't have an alternative route. Are we actively looking at that?
Yes, we are. Yes, we have. The trip cancellations that we advised you of back on September 23rd and that we implemented on the 24th, the ones I listed earlier today, were done with exactly that thinking in mind. Every one of them has a negative effect on customers, but we were very carefully selecting them so that we were not stranding anybody. Everyone else still has some choice. It is not as good as the one they had before. In every case, it means a longer waiting time for a bus. In some cases, it means a missed connection onto another bus because, you know, a 15-minute service that's been reduced to half hour interfacing with another route that's been reduced as well can result in missed connections. And we've been working to repair those as much as we can. But our main hope here is that when the trains are safe to return, when the trains are returned, we can gradually follow as more people move back from bus to train. We'll be able to reduce the number of buses that we need to commit to the R1 service and gradually put those back into by removing the need to make the trip cancellations that are currently in effect.
Great. So on that, I'll just continue to monitor the Route 24 specifically as time goes on in hopes that, you know, where the parallel systems aren't there or missing. I just don't like seeing the count that high. And I told my constituency I'd bring it up. And I know you're working very hard on it, Pat, so don't get me wrong. My next series of questions is more train related. So with Bombardier and Alstom being the same company now, when it comes to RTG, what do you guys do? Are you pulling resources now that you have more access to people through Bombardier?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can take that. Absolutely. So, you know, what we've seen is that, you know, the merger, what's happened is Bombardier actually had a much more mature services business in North America. And we are now able to draw on that, on those people, on that expertise. And Alstom has brought an army of people to Ottawa. They expect their technician resources to go up by as much as 60 or 70%, as well as resources that are looking at the QC QA processes, looking at the track issues, looking at the vehicle issues. So I can tell you that they brought in additional resources, and majority of those are legacy Bombardier people who have much more experience.
And that's good. I think Councillor Leeper was being too polite in asking these questions. I'm going to just dive right in.
Sure.
Back when incidents started occurring, even last year, a couple years ago, have you guys been swinging the axe and firing people that frankly haven't done their job? And if so, is that taking place now?
So we've certainly held people accountable. Understanding, I think I alluded to earlier, most of the issues we've had have been component issues related to design of the vehicle that require retrofits. That this is the first significant incident we've had that has been related to workmanship or a failure for somebody to do something. So, you know, people have been held accountable for sorts of other issues. But as far as vehicle incidents, I mean, accountability is more on the side of response or the lack of response to incidents, for example. That for sure we have, yes.
Okay. I had a couple more quick questions, actually from Councillor Luloff. He was unable to continue on the call. He had other meetings. Real quick, were the running hours reduced during COVID? And part two to that, was the maintenance staff reduced during COVID?
I'll answer the second question. The first one, maybe that somebody from the city can answer. No, we were fortunate enough. We did have a couple of outbreaks that lasted for a couple of weeks where some of the technicians, on the whole, I think we were quite lucky and fortunate that it didn't impact us greatly. The other question I'll defer to the city.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I can take that answer. Throughout the pandemic, we haven't reduced the operating hours, but as you may recall, we have reduced train frequency. So we haven't been running the 15 and 13 trains in the AM and peak periods. It's been primarily the 11 trains. And if you recall, prior to the August 8 derailment, the plan was to start ramping up through the month of August to 15 trains in the AM and 13 in the PM, and then start September with those increased frequencies. So to answer your question, we haven't reduced the operating hours, but the frequency of trains was reduced during the pandemic.
Okay, great. Well, I want to thank everyone that's joined today, and I hope RTG and the rest continue to take part in these very important meetings. I think getting some of these questions is very important, and don't get me wrong, I'm still not comfortable with you guys yet, and that's only because of the history at this point, and I think you recognize that. And we want it safe, and the next time the train's turned on, we need it to stay on. So anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to get my questions in today.
Thank you, Councillor Tierney. So it's basically quarter two, so we'll come back at 5 minutes after two, if that's good for everybody. We'll start with Councillor Kavanaugh, followed by Commissioner Gilbert, Wright Gilbert, and Councillor McKinney. Okay, thank you all.